Good evening, folks, and welcome to another edition of Dead Pit Radio. How's everybody doing?
I'm doing killing. It's been a wonderful week, aside from the fact that Chris Benoit killed his family and stuff.
Yeah, Chris Benoit's apparently got a bad habit of choking a lot of people to death.
We'll be talking about that a little bit later. It's not really horror related, but we're...
It is horror related.
Well,
it's
horror movie related, yeah. At least. We'll be talking about that a little bit later.
If you just tuned into this show, by the way, I am Uncle Bill.
I'm the Creepy Kentucky.
And we are your hosts, and this is Dead Pit Radio. And this is a little show we like to do every now and then where we talk about all the latest DVD news and reviews. And
we are Horror Talk Radio at its finest.
We're going to have an interview in here, too.
We do. We have the interview part one, actually, because it's a two-part interview. For some reason, we cannot stop talking to these people that do these DVDs. Michael Felcher, he is the grand dragon of horror DVDs.
I don't know if he necessarily wants you to call him that, but yeah. He's like one of the people that were the innovators back in the day when Anchor Bay was getting a lot of the main horror DVD titles that everyone knows him for now. He's also like one of the guys that wrote a lot of the liner notes for those DVDs and did a lot of the research on a lot of the movies that were released. And he's got his own little company now.
A very in-depth interview. This is, yeah, probably one of our better interviews of all time, I think. What do you think?
Yeah, it's probably one of my favorites and definitely my favorite we've done in a long, long time.
Yeah, I mean, the first part of the interview is pretty much a background on, you know, Michael Felcher and Red Shirt Pictures and how that came to be. Now, next week, part two, pretty much every movie that's not on DVD, horror movie, we ask him about, like, not every one of them.
Well,
a good majority of them.
Yeah, I made a list, and I think you made a list, and we were both talking. Like, we were naming off horror films that were not out on DVD that we were asking, you know, what are the chances of this being on DVD? Who's got the rights to it? What's going on with it? And he, you know, answered almost all the questions that we had.
Yeah, and a few of them he thinks possibly on their way. So we'll get to that. That's next week. But this week, pretty much a background. I think we'll lead up to The Diary of the Dead. He's working with George Romero on Diary of the Dead. So you get to hear about that.
Yeah, he's going to tell you a lot about some of the misconception about the film and what exactly it's going to be about and how it's going to be filmed. And that's really interesting because I was kind of worried it was going to be a Blair Witch kind of project, but he assures us that it's not that. So you'll hear more about that.
You'll hear all that later. We have DVDs to get to. We have reviews, as always. We talk about way too many horror DVDs on this show. I don't know why.
Because it's a service to the fans.
Yeah.
It is a service to people that, you know, shouldn't have to watch shitty horror films.
We're reviewing one, though, that should make all the people happy that loves these old-ass fucking movies, because we've got one from 1959, Ray Kellogg, who the same year actually did another movie called The Killer
Shrews
or something like that. This is the Giant Gila Monster, okay?
It's the Giant Gila Monster!
Giant Gila Monster!
The Giant Gila Monster!
Giant Gila Monster!
We've got that one for review.
That's right.
And then we've got a film that I think this is one of those films that CK and I are going to have to agree to disagree on. This is a recent Lionsgate release. Well, it's not even been released yet. It'll be released in, I think, a couple months, actually. This is Dead Clowns.
It sure is. Got another film from Anthem Pictures. Brand new company started sending us a bunch of their releases. Bloodshed is the name of this one.
Yeah, and a film that I had heard a lot about before I ever got a chance to see it. And I think a lot of people talk about it along the same lines. They talk about Necromantic and a lot of films like along those lines. I've got Aftermath Genesis, which is actually three films from Nacho Cerda. The Awakening, Aftermath, and Genesis being all short films of his. And we're going to be reviewing all those.
Those are also from Anthem Pictures.
Yeah, those are our good friends at Anthem Pictures.
So, yeah, got a lot of good stuff to talk about this week. And those movies, I was definitely looking forward to.
I'm just curious, though. We were talking about this earlier, about when Nacho Cerda's brother, Quesadilla Cerda, is going to be starting in film.
Well, plus his son's already started to make film. His son's like 12 years old, Nacho Belgrande Cerda.
Yeah.
Yeah, so be on the lookout for them. I mean, those both of those guys.
Those are bound to be quality films, though. So let's get started with the news.
Okay. I got some more news, small news, on a Halloween remake. Our buddies over at Bloody Disgusting have learned that Bill Moseley and Leslie Easterbrook will both have small roles in the Rob Zombie reimagining of Halloween, which is slated to be released on August the 31st. So fans out there, if you thought Zombie had, you know, enough rejects before, well, he's got two more now. So
And the question here is it reshoots, or is he just trying to cram as many people that he knows in this film? Is he trying to set a record for working with people from past projects?
Yeah, I think like there's some sort of deal going around with Rob Zombie and these horror conventions, these promoters, these horror conventions, so they can make more money that way. Like they can have huge Halloween reunion with people that are always already going to be there anyway.
Right. Because they're there all the time.
Yeah.
They're there 24/7.
Yeah.
Synapse Films has just posted the cover art for their DVD of Black Roses. If you haven't seen this cover art, this is probably one of my all-time favorite covers for any DVD.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's an amazing design.
It's like an unofficial sequel to Rock and Roll Nightmare, yeah. I believe. The same guy directed it. It
says the 1988 rock and roll horror film by director John Fasano. The disc will sport a new high-definition anamorphic widescreen transfer with audio commentary by Fasano and friends and cast and other extras. It will street September the 25th with a $19.95 retail price.
Indeed.
It'd be nice.
So look forward to that one. The Bates Motel TV series, okay? They tried this back in the late 80s, early 80s. I don't even remember when that was. You remember the Bates Motel TV movie?
I do.
Which was supposed to spawn a new TV series. I think Bud Cort was the star of that. But now, production company Vertigo Entertainment, who was going to be bringing us The Invasion, which looks unbelievably shitty.
Nicole Kidman?
Yeah. Oh. And they also brought us The Ring and The Grudge. They have inked a first-look television deal with Lionsgate to develop and produce scripted programming for broadcast and cable. Now, this is according to The Hollywood Reporter. Vertigo will be making its first foray into scripted television with The Bates Motel. Now, this is a reimagining of Psycho that's being developed with Universal Media Studios. So we can all look forward to that or not. I don't know.
Yeah, it really depends. You never...
yeah. The Psycho series, as a lot of you people know, I love all the movies pretty much. I mean, I'm glad to see that part four, The Beginning, is finally coming on DVD, but I'm waiting on the Bates Motel TV movie.
Yeah.
Is that ever going to come out?
I'm really looking forward to having those in my collection because I don't have 2, 3, or 4. And I know that you have 2 and 3 and you don't have 4, but they're coming out on that 4, special
yep.
edition.
This will be the first time 4 will ever be yeah. out, isn't this triple threat
so,
pack or whatever.
Yeah, that's just made my whole month and year to know that that's coming out finally. Here's some good news for people that are anywhere around Orlando or Hollywood. New Line Universal are teaming up for the new Halloween Horror Nights. Horror Nights.
Horror.
And here's what one of the representatives had to say. He says, we're announcing for the first time ever a very exciting partnership between Universal Studios Orlando, Universal Studios Hollywood, and New Line Cinema for the introduction of the New Line characters Freddy, Jason, and Leatherface to the Halloween Horror Nights events on both coasts. Is Jim Timmons, Senior Vice President of Entertainment for Universal Parks and Resorts. He says, this is by far our biggest Halloween event ever. New Line Cinema brings an incredible horror tradition with Freddy, Jason, and Leatherface, and now at Universal we could take those characters and environments that have only existed in the cellular world and make them real. The Halloween Horror Nights event, which takes place over the course of 23 evenings in Universal Studios Orlando, is between September the 28th to November the 3rd in Orlando and October the 5th to October the 31st in Hollywood.
Hmm.
And that means that you're going to have all the Universal monsters, plus Jason, and like you said, Jason, Freddy, and Leatherface.
And they're going to evidently have them in their natural environment there.
That's right.
So that's pretty cool. I mean, if anybody is in that area...
He even mentioned something in here, though, that this is going to be the beginning of some kind of partnership with New Line and Universal. He says it's kind of a complex deal, but this is the discussion about the New Line villains began a couple of years ago where we recognized that that would be somewhere we might want to go in the future. So we struck a very strong creative relationship with the people at New Line. Those characters are so richly developed and have such great backstories and environments. We specialize in immersive environments, which will be what they'll be doing at the little theme Halloween Horror Night themes. Wouldn't it be amazing, though, if they could have something where they took the Universal Monsters and did some kind of versus Freddy? They could have, like, you know,
Frankenstein
versus Freddy. That'd be awesome. Wolfman versus Leatherface.
Yeah. I think what would be even cooler is if they could get, like, Robert Englund to be Freddy during that time, like, hire him.
They'd have to pay him $25,000 if he was there for, like, a day.
$25,000 a day.
Yeah. I mean...
$25,000
a day, but I don't want nothing cheaper than that. And, you know, that just pays for his sweater. That
sweater's on loan. That's true. We have some news on the Prom Night remake.
Really? That's a shame.
Yeah, we've already announced that the movie will be rated PG-13. But a new interview with the star Brittany Snow reveals more about the supposed horror film that's less than exciting. Now, she continued on to say in the interview, there's no blood, guts, or gore, and it's going to be more of a thriller. So, yeah, you got a prom night remake. There's going to be no blood, no guts, no gore. There you go. PG-13.
I'm really, really getting... I mean, I know a lot of people have been talking about this for a long time, but PG-13 movies are really starting to fucking upset me. And it's not just because they're PG-13, because I know that stories and plots play a big role in movies, too. It's just the films that they're turning to PG-13 films, like Live Free or Die Hard is PG-13. How in the shit does that make any sense?
Yeah.
That any, or Prom Night, for that matter. Any of those films could be PG-13. They're not...
I think a lot of what's causing that, though, is the stuff that's making a ton of money, like the Shreks and the Pirates of the Caribbean and Spider-Man. All that stuff's PG-13. And for some reason, all these guys think that every movie that's PG-13 is going to be like a blockbuster, or it has the potential to be a blockbuster, whereas all the rated R films are, at best, are going to make their money back, maybe a little more, I guess. I don't know, though. I mean... You saw when a Stranger Calls, the remake for that, which was PG-13.
I can understand you want to make PG-13 films. That way you assume that a lot of people can get into the films that couldn't get into R-rated films. Even though I never really had that problem when I was a kid. They might have cracked down on that now, but they'd let anybody, they'd let a 6-year-old kid into an R movie back in the day.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is, pick and choose the damn movies you want to be PG-13. You can't make certain movies that way. It just doesn't work.
That's true.
But anyway, here's two other really quick stories. I can't believe this hasn't happened up till now, but there's never really been an official website for Dario Argento. There's been tons of, like, fan websites and a couple of websites concerning, like, there's one with, like, an antique shop that had some of his memorabilia in the bottom basement of it. I'm trying to remember what the name of that was.
I think it's just called Profondo Rosso, yeah, the name of the shop.
Yeah. But this is, it says that, www.darioargento.it will be online soon, and that will be the official website for Argento in the future. So it'll actually be, I guess, sanctioned by him. And also, really quickly, the Burning soundtrack is a long out of print soundtrack for 1981's film The Burning, will be released August 28th as part of a series of CDs showcasing the work of Rick Wakeman, who's actually from the band Yes. Mm-hmm. Who was a pretty amazing keyboard synth player, but unfortunately went insane and started to do like on ice operatic stuff, where he would do synth solos.
That's
while
people skated. Serious.
Yeah. But it says the CD contains 36 minutes of remastered music consisting of all the 11 tracks, basically the theme from The Burning all the way down to the end.
I'm surprised. I'm surprised how they were releasing that. Not really that good of a soundtrack. I've got it.
Yeah, and Rick Wakeman. I mean, I understand he was a good keyboard player, but the sumbitch was like one of the most egomaniacal musicians ever. Mm-hmm. And that's just amazing that they would, you know, kind of feel his grandiosity with releasing another edition of that soundtrack.
Well, I'm sure, yeah. He probably just wants to forget that he even did that, knowing how he is. But
I don't know. He probably really wants to forget the on-ice opera he did, too.
Oh, he likes that, too. He's proud of that. All right, we'll take a quick break, and we have a few more news topics to get to, and we're going to have Michael Felcher from Red Shirt Pictures on the show in a little bit here on DeadBit.com.
Hey, DeadBit fans, sorry for all the noise. You know, sometimes you just can't keep a good bitch down. This is The Butcher from KillerReviews.com, and I wanted to fill you guys in on some of the changes. We have a brand new look for 2007, we now have hundreds of staff reviews and thousands of user reviews, and interviews with directors like Tim Sullivan, Brett Leonard, Edward Sanchez, and the hotties like Carrie Ann Fleming, Shawnee Smith, Joanna Brewster, and Jenny Wade from Feast. And I'm telling you folks, I'm dying to feast on those beautiful titties! And of course, we got features like The Graveyard and Girls of Horror always expanding, so swing by and check us out. That's KillerReviews.com. You better, because I give Uncle Phil 3 blowjobs in his fucking ass spot. Now, if you'll excuse me, folks. I told you, bitch! No salt and pepper on my cottage cheese!
Howdy ho, everybody, and welcome back to Dead Pit Radio. We're going to talk about the Return of the Living Dead Collector's Edition. Now, the artwork for this is now available over on the deadpit.com message board.
It's shitty.
The disc will be released, oddly enough, on September 11th.
9/11? God, that doesn't bode well for it, does it?
Yeah, I mean, we get to talking about this with Michael Felcher, too, about the Monster Squad artwork. It seems like all of these companies don't want to use the classic artwork from the 80s or 70s, whatever it's from. Like, another one, besides Return of the Living Dead and Monster Squad, is From Beyond. The artwork on that is absolutely horrible.
Yeah, and it seems to me like, and I know we talked to him about this, they're trying to hip it up or something. They're trying to make it seem like, for the younger crowd, that it's something that they really should buy, even if they don't know what the hell the movie is. And that's, I don't know. I guess if that sells more DVDs, that's fine, but I just would really prefer the original poster art to be on these DVDs.
Or at least do something like this. Put the crappy new art on one side and put, like, the original art on the flip side where you can, you know.
Yeah, they did that with a couple of Dark Sky films at one time. Yeah. But they had the Henry Portrait of Serial Killer where you could flip the cover.
I think that would be cool to do that, but, you know. I mean, there's a lot of artwork that's like that nowadays. I don't know why. You know, a lot of the major studios do that. You know, the only companies that really stick to the original artwork usually is like Anchor Bay and Blue Underground.
Yeah.
So.
But here's some news about a good friend of the show, Bruce Campbell. It says that old Bruce is going to make his return to series television with the USA Network series Burn Notice, which airs Thursdays at 10 p.m. starting this week on June the 28th.
You want to take bets on how long that series will last?
No, because it probably won't last any longer than any of his other series.
Well, it's not just Bruce Campbell's series. Like, the USA Network, for some reason, they can never hang on to a TV series. Because
they're almost like Spike with television series. I couldn't tell you how many original series Spike has had that went down the shooter.
Yeah, I mean, it's just...
Spy, who gets the information that he's been suddenly terminated, his assets frozen, and his name put on a government watch list so he can never work again, setting out to uncover the reasons why and fleeing old enemies, Michael hooks up with Campbell's Sam Axe, a former colleague now retired and living the good life in Miami's South Beach. The series also stars Gabriel Anwar and Sharon Gleese. An exclusive video of Campbell discussing Burn Notice can be found at a website here, which I do not have the current information for, and I'm sorry.
You can find that.
Yeah. Bruce Campbell's been in more TV series than anybody ever. You remember Jack of All Trades?
Oh, yeah. That's actually a pretty popular series, if you can believe that, like for cult status.
I don't know
status.
Why.
He was in a lot of Xena Warrior Princess episodes, too.
Anyway, there may be a House of Wax, too.
Oh, good.
In a recent interview, the absolutely beautiful and luscious and tittylicious Alicia Cuthbert mentioned that there is a sequel to the film back in, what was it, 2005?
Yeah.
House of Wax.
Most notable because Paris Hilton got killed in that film.
And she said that she would be back in the sequel. And I'm surprised they're doing it because the film wasn't that big of a success, was it? I mean, I did like the movie.
I don't think it was that big of a success. So I just think the Paris Hilton novelty thing was why a lot of people went to see it. But, yeah, like you said, I didn't think it was that bad of a film. Yeah.
I think a lot of people already, like, shitting on it before they actually saw it, and they were just went in wanting to hate it, but, you know, that's probably the people that didn't like it. But, yeah, it is a fun little slasher movie. There's not a lot of slasher films that are released theatrically, nationally at least, so I liked it.
I enjoy it, but then again, I enjoy anything that she's in. I enjoy just watching her boobs.
I enjoy anything that's entertaining.
I enjoy anything with boobs in it. Okay, writer-director Ethan Terrace is gearing up to direct a new film called Black Friday, which begins shooting in Arizona later this month. And it's apparently the story starts 20 years ago in Arizona, where 10-year-old Tyler Hilberg kills his mother and her lover in cold blood on the 4th of July. That Friday, Black Friday, would be a day Leo would never forget. Needless to say, the bloodshed is far from over. He says, I really wanted to do an up-to-date film while embracing the feel of classic chillers, and that's what Black Friday is all about. It's chock full of suspense that modern-day horror films have forgotten about. I really want to give the audience that suspense of the killer is everywhere. Now, this story is of note because the title derives from a Freddy vs. Jason sequel script Tara wrote that wound up being rejected. But it did forge a relationship with Friday 13th creator Sean S. Cunningham, whose son Noel is partnered with Tara on Black Friday. Says more Friday franchise veterans will be involved as well. Tara reveals Harry Manfredini will score the movie, and we're also negotiating with Kane Hodder.
Sounds awesome. Look forward to that. Kill Bill, the whole bloody affair. Now, we all know that for years we've been promised the uncut, complete Kill Bill film. And finally, on November 6th, Kill Bill, the whole bloody affair will be released. Now, pre-orders are already up on Amazon.com. So if you want to go ahead and get your order in, you can go ahead and do that on Amazon.
We've been talking about this forever, but I still can't wait for that to come out. I think I'm one of the few people that, after going back and watching the Kill Bill Volume 2 again, actually like that film.
Yeah,
as well.
But you're one of those people that tries to talk yourself into liking something just because you like Quentin Tarantino.
No, I'm not. I don't even really like Quentin Tarantino. Yeah, I didn't like Jackie Brown at all.
I don't care. That Kill Bill Volume 2 is shitty. You know it was. But yeah, Kill Bill, the whole bloody affair, November 6th. Check it out. I'm going to get it.
See Friday the 13th on location where it was shot.
I want to do that.
I actually really would like to do that, but it's never going to happen.
Because it still looks the same.
Yeah, it looks exactly the same from the pictures I've seen. It says, you can see the Slasher Classic in the very environment where it was filmed. The Blairstown Theater Festival is offering just such an opportunity. On Friday, July 13th, the group will be showing Sean S. Cunningham's original Friday the 13th at Roy's Hall.
Ah, fuck.
On 30 Main Street in Blairstown, New Jersey.
That's another Friday the 13th show we're going to do.
You just thought about that?
Friday, July 13th.
Yeah, that's the same time that that other thing's happening, too.
That other thing we'll probably announce next week.
Yeah, that other thing that we don't announce right now. It says there will be two shows at 6:30 and 8:30 at the Blairstown Theater. Also, tell us that an 11 p.m. show will be added if those sell out. It says Ron Milicki, who plays the hostel officer Dorf in the movie, will be in attendance, and other Friday folks are being sought to take part as well. Tickets are $10 for ordering and further information. You can check out the Blairstown Theater Festival. There you go.
That's right.
July 13th, be there.
Another thing that we've both been waiting for, and I knew it was coming, I just didn't know when, was the Masters of Horror, the complete first season, which arrives on August the 28th. The package includes all 13 of the previously issued discs, from Don Coscarelli's Incident on and Off a Mountain Road to Takashi Miike's Imprint, plus a 14th bonus disc of never-before-seen extras. These are Masters of Horror Dinner. Creator Mick Garris assembles the Season 1 directors at Hollywood's legendary Magic Castle. In addition, you also have Masters of Horror DGA panel discussion and a couple of Fantasy Film Festival cable segments with Mick Garris interviewing such people as Steven Spielberg and John Borman. Now, this set is limited to 20,000 units and retails at $79.97. Yeah, this set, if you haven't got the Masters of Horror, any of the Masters of Horror DVDs, this is the set to get. Excellent price, I think, for this. 14 discs.
Mm-hmm.
Retail $80, and it's going to be about $60 on deep discount, so.
Yeah, and plus the added fact that it's in like a mausoleum style right. box. It's awesome.
Any of your DVD collectors out there that likes to hang on to something for a couple of years and then sell it, this is a pretty good one, I would say,
yeah.
because it's limited to 20,000 pieces, so it's not going to last that long.
The last story that I've got, though, SRS Cinema, which I believe is Sub Rosa, passed on the word that it will release the hard-to-find 1981 Supernatural Vengeance flick Kiss Daddy Goodbye to DVD September 25th.
Kiss Daddy Goodbye, baby!
This is directed and co-written by Patrick Reagan and only previously released on obscure VHS labels in the 80s. Here's the really weird part about this film. The movie stars Marilyn Burns from the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre and 50s and 60s pop idol Fabian in the story of a father who is murdered before his young children's eyes by a biker gang. It says retail price is $29.95. The uncut movie will be accompanied on the disc by a photo gallery and trailer.
Marilyn Burns is in that.
We're going to get to meet Marilyn Burns.
We are. We're going to get to see you. We're going to get to meet Ed Neal and Alan Danziger and Gunnar Hansen and everybody else.
Tiffany Shabes.
Sure, that's going to be the funniest shit. If you got to bring your movie camera along because I've got to record when you meet her.
Why?
Because that's going to be the funniest shit I've ever seen.
Oh, buddy. What the hell ever. She's going to get to meet me.
I'm sure that's how she's looking at it.
I got a pat on my twat because I'm going to meet CK.
That's right.
She's got to do that. She's got to be smelling nice to me.
She's got that special mess of greens cologne on for you.
our buddies at Metropole NYC, Monday, July the 2nd, 10 p.m., Basket Keith.
Frank Ian Lauder's Killer.
We need to get
That's
Frank Ian Lauder on the show.
Yeah, I think we tried. But
we need to really do that, though. I mean, I've got his contact. Email a guy, Frank Ian Lauder. Come on, Dead Pit. We need you on here.
Yeah, I'd love to get him on the show. So DVD releases for July the 3rd. Day of the Axe, the special edition from Brain Damage, is coming out. Dead Man's Hand, Casino of the Damned from Wizard Entertainment. That sounds like a killer one. Ghoulies 4 is coming out from Echo Bridge. I can't believe somebody released that. That's cool.
Ghoulies 4, baby. I ain't asked for that. I want that.
Mummy Maniac, which I believe you have a written review up from
Lionsgate. Mummy Maniac is actually, I got the new written review up on there on the site. Yeah. Uli the Male, buddy.
Yeah, we'll see about that. You got to go check that out. Sodom the Killer, not Saddam the Killer, Sodom.
Saddam Hussein, yeah, yes.
From Tokyo Shock Media Blasters. The Stephen King DVD collector set. I don't know how many fucking Stephen King DVD collector sets there are, but
15.
Here's another one. Carrie, the Dark Half, Misery, and Needful Things for this set. The Tomb from York is coming out. Welcome to the Grindhouse, Evil Eye, and Black Candles from BCI Eclipse. And With You from Passion River.
Passion River?
Passion River! We're gonna go down to the Passion River. Gonna go down and fuck.
Alright, so I guess it's time. It's time.
Is it Vader time?
It's Vader time. No, it's Felcher time.
It is. It's the MF-er time. Michael Felcher.
That's right. Okay, so yeah. The first part of the interview with Michael Felcher from Red Shirt Pictures, all horror fans are going to love this because I really did like it.
Yeah, people that really like to hear us go on and talk about horror and DVDs. And
DVDs, baby,
you're going to love this interview because this is nothing but us geeking out with somebody else that's as much a fan of the genre as we are. So here it is.
Or even more so. Michael Felcher on DeadPit.com. First of all, just tell us about what first got you into the horror genre and what some of your favorite films were growing up.
Oh, you know, it's funny. When I was a little kid, I was always kind of scared of horror movies. I couldn't even handle, like, the strong parts of Raiders of the Lost Ark or Star Trek II. I mean, I'd always go running up out, the aisles whenever the skulls would pop out and, harass Karen Allen in that one sequence. Or it was funny, I had a problem with, in Star Trek II, I had no problems with the eel coming out of Chekhov's ear with the blood, but going in, I couldn't take it. Mm-hmm. It was really kind of weird what I was afraid of back then. But what happened was, I think my dad really sensed that I was interested in that stuff, but kind of wary of it. So he sat me down one night and said, "Here's this movie that I really found was a lot of fun. It's got some scary parts and it's got some gross parts, but it's all make believe. But it's fun. I think you'll enjoy it." And he sat there and watched my first horror movie with me, which was Creepshow.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a ball. I mean, it was just from that point on, it was just like whatever I could get my hands on as far as horror, that was anything and everything. And it was after that that Dawn of the Dead, the original Dawn of the Dead came up, and that was pretty much what did it for me, is not only wanting to be a, just a full-time horror fan, but just wanting to be actually more of a filmmaker as well.
So when did you start to realize that you might want to have something to do with horror films for a living?
When I was in high school, I did some short films and stuff that I really enjoyed. They were kind of goofy kind of things. One was about these little doughboy creatures that run around the house, and this guy runs around smashing and killing them. It was really inspired by like Evil Dead 2 and Bad Taste. And then the second short film I did was called Breakfast Club Goes to Hell, which was a silent slasher film set in a school where these kids are, there for detention, and one by one they get offed by this guy who ends up turning out to be the principal. I mean, the plots themselves were nothing much, but I really enjoyed just sort of, experimenting with, because I found with video, it's really hard to do on the video format, it's really hard to do horror without it coming across being really silly. So I had a lot of humor in these things, and it was kind of fun to just to experiment, and that was kind of where I was heading. And then after I left high school, I wanted to get into it full time, but I had a video project that I was working on that I had a lot of hope for that fell apart on me right after high school, and I didn't pick up a camera again for like 10 years. It was sort of the albatross around the neck sort of thing, and it just kind of, it was always my interest to do to direct and to do horror films and stuff like that, but it never, I was never able to get it going again. So for most of my 20s, I just kind of had jobs that were in and around related to movies. You know, worked at a video distributor for a few years, and you know, it was kind of just tacitly involved with the movie industry. At the time, I was living in Charlotte, North Carolina, so it was pretty much a dead end as far as pursuing any kind of career as far as the video industry and filmmaking per se. It wasn't until I got the job with Anchor Bay where that really became more of a possibility.
So how did that start?
Well, that started in kind of an unusual way. I was working, as like I said, at a video distributor called Major Video Concepts, and that was back in the days when there were a lot of distributors that would, you know, buy the tapes from the studios and then, you know, dole them out and ship them to all the mom-and-pop video stores. Well, by 1997, that business model was sort of becoming obsolete. A lot of the stores were going direct with the studios, and a lot of the mom-and-pop operations were drying up. So I lost that job in the beginning of 97, and around that time I was really getting into the Internet. And at that time, the Internet was still pretty fresh. It was still pretty new. Not a whole lot of people were, certainly not compared to today.
Wow.
And I started a website because I was big into letterboxing, widescreen movies on Laserdisc and also VHS. And at that time, DVD was just about to hit. And I did a website called Widescreen Central, which was all about widescreen movies on VHS. You know, what was out, what was coming out, who was bringing out what. And at that time, Anchor Bay Entertainment was starting to release a lot of the cult and horror films, of course the ones I loved, on video cassette in VHS, in widescreen. So I dedicated a whole page to them on the site, and then they didn't have their own website. So I did a fan site for them, essentially. I registered anchorbayentertainment.com and went and just did a fan site about Anchor Bay Entertainment. I would call up like every other week and speak to a guy over there. His name was Jay Douglas. He was the VP of acquisitions at the time. I'd talk to him, you know, originally started out being like once a month, then it was every couple of weeks, then every week, then every day, then twice a day. And what ended up eventually happening was over the course of the next couple of years, I kept doing that, and eventually they offered me a chance to come up to Troy, Michigan, and help maintain and run their website, because they finally decided to get into actually having a website. And they offered me a job, to leave Charlotte and come up to Troy. And believe me, when that came up, I couldn't have gotten out of there fast enough.
What led to you starting up Red Shirt Pictures?
Red Shirt Pictures didn't officially start until I went up to Anchor Bay in July of 2000. They're almost 5 years. And I mean, I was kind of like a utility infielder. I kind of did a little bit of everything there. I wrote liner notes, did research, helped find acquisitions, helped out in the, track down artwork. I mean, just a whole lot of different things. I was the initial person. I tracked down the rights for Hills Have Eyes and, turned that over to acquisitions, and they made that deal. I mean, in a way, I had kind of the easy job. You know, I would find out who owned it. Then I would turn it over to my boss, and he would have to do the months of sweating out the deal and, losing sleep every night. So I did a lot of that stuff, but what ended up happening was that while I was there, of course, they had an established production team doing featurettes and documentaries there, first with Bill Lustig's team, which at that point was mostly David Gregory. And then after those guys left, the new production staff, they had Perry Martin and R.J. Gallantine, who have done pretty much everything since then.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done a great job. And the problem was, it really wasn't a way in my position in the company to kind of move into that, because A, they already had an established team, and my position was kind of it was always a strange one in the company. This always seemed to happen to me whenever I had a cool job. It was always a great job, but there was never a next logical step up. So what ended up happening was I really was getting the Jones to start videotaping and start filming again. And it was early on in 2004, and we were getting ready to release Night of the Demons.
Right.
And we weren't going to be spending a lot of money on that title. I mean, it was an important title, and we were going to do a new transfer and uncut and had a commentary. But I thought, I'd really like to see an interview with Linnea Quigley, because she had so many memorable scenes in that movie. And as it turned out, she was going to be at a convention in April of that year in Westlake, Ohio, right down the road from me. It was only like a couple hours away. And I thought, I'm going to hook it up with a couple friends. I'm going to go down there, talk to her, see if I can go ahead and do the interview, edit the thing. Because by that point, I'd really starting to get some training on Adobe Premiere and kind of get into the whole nonlinear editing system thing. And I thought, well, you know what? I'll just go take a chance, film her, do the interview, present it to Anchor Bay. If they like it, they can use it. If not, you know, no harm, no foul. I mean, at this point, I figured I had really nothing to lose. And we went and did the interview. Linnea, who I actually just saw this past weekend, could not have been sweeter about the whole thing. She volunteered her time to do it. I had a couple of great friends, Mike Watt and Amy Lynn Best, who volunteered the use of their camera and their time and set up the whole thing and got it back, edited it within a few days, and presented it to Anchor Bay, and they went, wow, this is really good, and they put it on the disc. Cool. And so that was the first, time I used the Redshirt Pictures name. I wanted a name for my own company, and I had had one in high school, but I didn't want to use that one, so I just said, well, I was watching an episode of Star Trek. And I was remembering, oh, there was another red shirt guy. Because, of course, the red shirt guys in Star Trek, whenever they beam down to the planet, they always die in some horrible way.
Yeah.
And so I thought, for some reason, I was attracted to the idea of naming my company after those poor bastards who keep getting killed in Star Trek. So I thought, okay. And so that became Red Shirt Pictures Presents, and it was My Demon Nights with Linnea Quigley, and that was the first one I did. And that was for Anchor Bay, and that was in August of 2004 is when that came out. But that was the only one I did for Anchor Bay while I was still working there.
Now, you've worked with a lot of the elite genre studios and some mainstream studios and stuff. Was it more difficult talking the studios into doing it, or did they just contact you, or how does that work?
I would say 95% of all the work that I've done in the past few years has all been stuff that I've sent out proposals on, just unsolicited. Mm-hmm. Very rare. I found it's very rare. I mean, the only jobs I can think of that have come to me based on work I've done previously, were like a couple things I did for Dark Sky and for Synapse. Mostly because I know Don, and he would just call me up and say, hey, I've got this thing.
Wow.
Or the other guys over at Dark Sky did it kind of the same way. With the studios, it was all putting together proposals and sending it off to them saying, hey, you've got such and such title. It's either the 25th anniversary or there's another movie coming out that would, you know, go well with promoting this title, and just hoping for the best. I mean, again, I find it's actually my experiences with the studios have been very positive overall. I mean, it's a different than dealing with a smaller studio in some regards, but it's not so much that they're the enemy or that they are in any way against bringing out smaller genre product. It's just that they've got so many things on their plate and so, you know, so many big blockbuster films and so many more high-profile things that sometimes they just don't have a chance to look for stuff. And it takes having something thrown in front of them and going, oh, well, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah.
And going, yeah, you know, it's also, this helped working at Anchor Bay for as long as it did. I mean, I worked a lot on the marketing side of it, too. So it's about talking to marketing people and saying, hey, look, you know, you got this. You can promote it with this. It's just like this movie coming up. And that is kind of like speaking a different language in a way.
So I guess it would be safe to say that as far as the content of the bonus features and what you talk about in the interviews, they pretty much give you free rein to do whatever you want.
Yeah, pretty much. I haven't really come across any situation where there's been a lot of censorship in that regard. They pretty much leave you alone. It's pretty much a situation where you outline what you want to do. You want to interview such and such. You think their documentary is going to be this long. You think you're going to have this many people and this many subjects. And they kind of approve a rough outline. And then you're free to go off and do whatever you want. I haven't really come across a situation yet where, I mean, every now and then, there's always, whenever you submit things for legal review, there's always a couple comments where it's like, well, okay, we really don't want him calling that girl a cocksucker on camera. And we really don't want, you know, there's always a few little things like that. But it's very rare that I've ever had, in fact, I can't even think of anything where they've gone, no, you will not have this section in there. And as far as time is concerned, it's really kind of a flexible thing. They've been very loose in regards to that kind of stuff.
What were some of the studios that you think more rejected some of your offers? Like, you know, if you send to a certain studio, are they more prone to just turn you down than others? Or,
well, I've worked with Fox, Sony, MGM, Lionsgate, you know, Anchor Bay, obviously, and a couple others, smaller ones, Synapse, Dark Sky. I haven't worked yet with Well, no, that's not true. I'm working with Universal in the UK right now, but their domestic operations I haven't worked with. And the only one I can think of that I submitted something to that got all-out rejected was to Warner Brothers when Creepshow came up.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I don't know. All I heard was back through a contact there that they had decided not to do it. It's not, you know, I didn't take it very personally, and it wasn't a situation where if they had sparked to it, they wouldn't have gone with me. It was just a matter of what's in their marketing plans for the next year, and if it's not something they'd even consider, they're not going to do it. But I have found that you never know what they're going to go for or what they're not going to go for. It's just a matter of putting an attractive package down in front of them and having them, you know, either spark to it or not. Because, I mean, the Creepshow proposal I put together I thought was the best one I'd ever done. So it did sting a little bit when I got it back saying they weren't interested. I was like, well, fine then, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you don't want to do it, then I'll just take my ball and go play somewhere else.
Right.
You know, but it was a bit more of a personal project for me. But, you know, sometimes they spark your ideas and sometimes they don't. But I've been lucky lately. Most of them have been gone over pretty well.
Cool. I was going to ask, though, about Paramount, if you'd ever tried to contact them about anything, because we've heard from a lot of people that they just want to stray away from the horror genre as much as possible.
I had a little bit of contact early on with them when they still controlled Monster Squad.
Mm-hmm.
And then also I was talking to them about I can't remember what it was, some series they had. And I just didn't get a lot of response back. But then again, I may not have been talking to the right people. That's another thing. That's almost 95% of the battle is finding the right people to talk to at these places.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you could get shuffled around from department to department. I don't want to deal with this one. This isn't my domain. And once you lock down and find the person who can actually do something and is actually on your wavelength in a way, that solves most of the problems right there, and you'll get premium. Because, like I said, the people that I've worked with at the studios have been great. I mean, I was worried when I did my first studio job with Chainsaw 2. I was like, oh god, this is gonna be a nightmare. Couldn't have been better. I couldn't have gotten more support, and they were responsive to all my ideas and did pretty much everything that I threw in front of them that was reasonable. And it's just a matter of finding the right person. But for Paramount, I don't have a lot of. I haven't had much more than just a couple of phone calls and a couple of emails back and forth.
Yeah, because I know they have a couple of titles that, you know, fans are going crazy wanting out on DVD, like Student Bodies is one. And
I think there are a couple over there that are, and I personally, just from a fan's perspective, I was never particularly thrilled with the Friday the 13th box set. If I feel a little strange criticizing, because I'm sure the producers who worked on that did their best, but and that may have been a more of a situation where they only wanted to do so much and they could only do so much.
Because mm-hmm.
The Paramount's attitude towards the Friday the 13th movies, and from my perspective, has always been, oh, we don't like these movies, we're ashamed of them, but we'll cash the checks. Mm-hmm. And I kind of felt that's kind of what the box set felt like to a large degree. I mean, the extras that were on there were very nice, but it wasn't nearly as definitive or as thorough as I would have liked, or as I think most people would have liked it to have been.
Yeah, I mean, I think the box set itself had the thin cases, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Double feature on each disc.
Yeah,
and stuff.
I mean, that would have been fine if they had loaded it up with, you know, a lot more deleted material.
Yeah, I was always curious about the uncut versions of the films that they float around on YouTube all the time, and they didn't include a lot of that on the DVDs.
Yeah. No, and again, I don't know if they ever went back into the vaults to try to find any of that stuff, because who knows if any of that stuff still exists in negative form or not, but the whole thing just kind of, for me, for just watching the stuff, kind of smacked of, okay, well, you've been asking for it. Here's something to shut you up.
Exactly, yeah.
Again, I'm not going to knock them too much for it because they didn't have to do anything. And it's being a producer, I see kind of both sides of the story. But I personally was disappointed in that set. And I'd give up 2 years worth of work just to do a real Friday the 13th, you know, 1 through 8 box set.
Yeah.
Because the new line discs have been very good.
Right.
The 1 through 8, I'd give anything to go back and do, like the real, like 2 discs for every movie and just like go back and do it all over again. But, you know, hey, I'd also like $1 million to fall from the sky, but that ain't going to happen right now either. So.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you though. You've got Project Consultant listed on a number of titles that are some of my favorites. And I was curious how you worked with these films, like for instance, Bad Taste.
Oh, you mean on the DVD?
Uh-huh.
On the DVD, I was involved in a couple of ways. I remember I was involved in getting the acquisition because I called up the New Zealand Film Commission originally on that one. This was back in the day. And, of course, what happened with that one was a little unfortunate in that we wanted to do a lot more for that. And Peter Jackson was willing to, but at the time he was starting up some Lord movie rings thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've never heard of it myself. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what that is.
But so he was apparently a little bit busy, and for like 10 years. So, you know, there was just no way to get him involved. So we ended up having a 2-disc set, which, quite frankly, could have easily fit on one. But I did interviews, or I hooked up some interviews with the cast members from New Zealand and for the booklet. And that was pretty much, I think, for Bad Taste, the limit of my involvement with that one.
And then there's probably my favorite edition of any film, the Dawn of the Dead Ultimate Edition.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that one. Now, how long did that one take? From the moment we started planning it and working on it, it was almost 3 years.
Yeah, because I remember hearing about it years ahead of time.
And yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. And it was just a matter of, there was so much stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, and that one, that was a labor of love for everyone. I mean, you talk about a project, when that finally came out, we all just looked at each other like, it was worth it. Everything we went through on this was worth it. My main involvement with that was in corralling a lot of the stuff, getting a lot of the materials together, making sure that all this, you know, I heard about, you know, I tracked down a guy who I'd once seen at a convention out in Los Angeles. This was like 3 years before we put the DVD out. A guy had home movie footage he took on the set because he was a zombie extra. I couldn't remember the name of the guy. And so I had to do some research and say, okay, I remember it was at this table, and the guy next to him, I remember who he was. Maybe he remembers who this guy was. And so that took like a year to find him. And so that, you know, we found him, a great guy, Robert Langer, who had shot all this stuff, and he gladly, you know, volunteered for the disc. There was some negotiations to put Document of the Dead on the disc, but the thing that I had my favorite moment by far as making the ultimate disc. I mean, again, it's a lot of people. I mean, Perry Martin did this wonderful documentary called The Dead Walk on there, which interviewed pretty much everyone who even walked by the set.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, the whole thing was so thorough, and the guys at Crest National, who at the time were the authoring house for Anchor Bay, did such an amazing job on all three versions of the film. And I attended the commentary session for Richard Rubenstein, which actually was very interesting. You know, with Richard Rubenstein, who I've had a really good relationship with the few times I've worked with him, you know, he had a reputation for being, and I'm not going to, I don't want to say the villain in this whole story with Dawn of the Dead, but he's not, you know, George is well beloved, and I guess Richard would have to be the side that isn't. Because Richard, you know, produced the Dawn remake, and he's known as the producer, as the businessman. And in a way, I was kind of worried about meeting him. I was just like, mm-hmm. I've heard a lot of stories about him, but you know what? I really liked Richard. He's a very practical guy. He's a very smart guy. And listening to him on that commentary track in the room while we were recording it, I was just like, this is a very thoughtful guy, a very interesting human being who actually, I think, cares very much for his film. So being able to be a part of that, to hear a side of a story I didn't think I'd hear, was really interesting. But as far as the Dawn of the Dead box set was concerned, the only thing that I was a real stickler in the mud for in that whole process is that I want a commentary with all four cast members.
Yeah.
In the room. I said I wanted that since the Laserdisc days, and it didn't happen, and I don't know what the logistics are concerned, but that one was me. I set that up. I got, we flew Scott Reiniger out to New York. Ken Forey was already there for a chiller convention at that time, and Galen Ross and David Emke both live in New York. And we did it in the conference room of the Helmsley Hotel down at 42nd Street. And it was the first time all four of them had seen each other since the movie had premiered. And I was there in the room, and I'm just they're going back and forth and ragging on each other and watching the movie, and I'm just geeking out the whole time. I'm just like, you got this is just too much. And I got a couple photos of all four of us together and everything. But for me, that was probably my most important contribution to that, was getting that set up and recorded, because for me, it's just like, we got to have all four of these guys. And it was, the commentary turned out great. I was really happy with it. So of everything, I would say that was probably my biggest contribution to that, was setting that up.
Yeah. I noticed you work a lot with Romero's films, though. I see that Day of the Dead's on here, Season of the Witch is on here, that you had project consultant credits on. Did you have a relationship with him before? I mean, did you know Romero personally?
Well, I mean, George Romero's been my favorite filmmaker since Creepshow. I mean, you know, he taught me more about filmmaking just by watching his films than I think I could have gotten from any film school. You know, I've learned about, you know, what it takes to really deeply terrify you at the same time, what's really great about character development. And, you know, not being afraid to make a statement with your movies, yet at the same time not beating your audience over the head with it to the point that they get annoyed with you.
Mm-hmm.
And all his films are so distinctive and unique to him. They feel like films from him rather than just some anonymous filmmaker who stepped in to say action. And so, naturally, I was just always attracted to that. And I think the first time I did anything is I wrote, the first thing I did for Anchor Bay ever was write the liner notes for their Martin and Knight Riders DVDs. And that was before I even officially worked for the company.
Yeah.
And then one thing just led to another, and it just seemed like I always was attracted to the Romero stuff. And the first time, I had met Tetna, and it's funny because I just found a picture of myself. I actually met George for the first time at the Monroeville Mall in 1996. There was a little signing he did there that Don May and Vinnie Boncolari, who at that time had Elite, were filming.
Mm-hmm.
And it ended up on the Laserdisc box set. It was a fan testimonial section at the very end, and there's a bit of me talking about Dawn of the Dead, and I had no idea that I was going to end up on the set until I bought the Laserdisc box and went, holy shit, there I am. And what was funny about that meeting was I hadn't met Don yet, and he became a great friend, and there were three or four other people in line at that show who have since come on to be great friends of mine who I'd never met that day. And I was just like, because like one of the guys was Mark Walcott, who went on to work for Criterion. He was like three people behind me. And it was just, like, weird that we all showed up here and we all didn't meet again until years later. So that was the first time I really met George. But then once I worked for Anchor Bay, we were working on Day of the Dead. We were working on Martin, all that stuff. So I kind of came into contact with him because of promotional opportunities and stuff like that. And, you know, I got lucky to I know one of the things I did for Anchor Bay was go to a lot of the conventions. I represented the company at a lot of the conventions in the Midwest and the East Coast and a couple on the West Coast. And so I got to know George through that. And then I just kept gravitating to his stuff because that's where I wanted to be. And, you know, I don't think there was a George project that came through there that I didn't want to have as much involvement on as possible.
And I was looking on IMDb and it had you as a, were you a zombie in the movie?
In Land of the Dead.
Yeah.
Yes. That was the best. Okay. I got a funny story about that.
Okay.
It was up there for 2 days. Chris Rowe, who is his appearance manager and also helps him with a lot of other stuff, helped get me up there. Because it was difficult because, you know, they were filming in Toronto and they weren't letting a lot of Americans come up there to be zombies because of the whole, everyone has to be Canadian, that sort of thing. I got kind of snuck onto the set. And the first night we're there and we're filming, I take it you guys have seen Land of the Dead a couple times.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, they were filming the scene where the Dead Reckoning pulls into this neighborhood, and it's when John Leguizamo's going to launch the missiles.
Right.
And they find him and stop him. Well, they were filming that scene this night, and it's an old, it was actually an unfinished housing development that probably now is like ultimate suburbia, and they have no idea they filmed a horror movie there. And it was cold. I mean, that whole shoot, if you ever have a chance to ask George, you know, to say what one word to describe Land of the Dead, he'll say cold, because they filmed outdoors at night for like, I don't know how many weeks. I mean, it was a real brutal shoot for him and for his crew, but it was a great crew, really nice people. And so I'm up there just visiting and saying hi and everything, and it's starting to get pretty cold out there. And they had one of the garages to the houses open, and what they had the crew, you know, like the cast and crew in there on director's chairs with monitors, and they had a huge space heater at the mouth of the garage, and this thing looked like it fell off of a jet plane. I mean, you could see fire roaring in this thing. And it was just belching out hot air into the, but you couldn't stand anywhere near the thing. You had to stand back at least 2 to 3 yards or you get burned. And you could see around the face of this heater, there were little globs of plastic and burnt fabric where people's scarves and buttons had caught on the thing, and it instantly melted to the face of the heater. So you knew pretty much to stay far away from it. So the cast was called out for a take, and I went up there because I didn't want to disturb them. And I'm freezing, so I go up there in the front, and I just stand at the mouth of the garage, and I'm just getting, like, the full blow of the heater. I'm just like, oh, yeah. I got my eyes closed. I'm like, ah, that's great. And all of a sudden, I become aware that there's someone standing to the right of me, and I look over, and it's Ozzy Argento. Uh-huh. And at that time, I was still with Anchor Bay, and we were getting ready to do a disc of Trauma. And I thought, you know, I should mention that we're going to do this. I should introduce myself. I should say, hi, I'm Michael Felcher with Anchor Bay. I've been a fan of your work. We're getting ready to do Trauma. Would you like to do an interview? That sort of thing, you know?
Right.
Perfectly, you know, I had this all planned out in my head. I turned to her, and I don't know what the hell happened. I turned to her, and I go, you pretty.
What?
Two words, you pretty. Just come out of my mouth, and I'm just standing there, and I can hear myself in my head just screaming, going, "You pretty? Well, what the hell? Abort! Abort! Say something else!" And I go, and I think the next sentence I say was, "You know, Trauma, where we're doing that, and you were good in that. I like that movie." And so she was very sweet, very nice, and I think she just assumed I didn't speak English. Because she was just like, yes, oh, thank you very much, thank you very much. She was very nice. By the mercifully, by the grace of God, she was called out for another take, so that ended that whole thing. But as she's walking out, she walks right past the big space heater without breaking her stride. She takes out an unlit cigarette, puts it in front of the space heater, it bursts into flames, and she starts smoking it without even breaking her stride. And I turn and I look over to my left, and there's a PA now that's been standing over there, and he looks at me after seeing that and goes, that was the coolest fucking thing I've ever seen. Yeah. And I just look at him and go, yeah, I was. And, you know, so it's like, I felt like such a shitty laugh. I was like, oh, my God, you pretty? What the hell happened?
It's like she made you regress back to, like, 2 years old.
I don't know what the hell happened, man, because, you know, and then you come across this, too. You know, you meet a lot of people that you've, you know, admired or enjoyed on screen before, and, you know, you learn to adopt a certain coolness. I mean, you get excited, but you don't act like a complete moron. And I just, I don't know what the hell happened, but a part of me broke at that moment. Mm-hmm. And so the next night, I got to be a zombie, which was great. So, but whenever I think about, you know, whenever I start getting a swelled head about, you know, hey, I was a zombie in a George Romero movie, I just hear two words floating through my head. You're pretty. And it's like, well, I better shut up because I remember what an idiot I was the first night. But, yeah, I got to be a zombie the second night, and that was mostly because Greg Nicotero, who I had met previously, he knew me, and he said, well, we really don't need anybody, but I'll try to get you in, and he did. And I ended up shooting on the main set with George. He actually was on, you know, wasn't like a second unit thing. And I'm in the movie. You can see me very clearly in the movie. It's the scene where the zombies attack the auto yard, and they push the fence over, and there's these guards up in the tower firing these M16s. Well, this one guard bails out, and as soon as he hits the ground, there's this big zombie that grabs him, and that's me. And I wrestle him to the ground, and then there's a couple other shots of me and other zombies feeding on him, and I'm wrestling with his arm, trying to bite his arm. Mm. And we did, like, two takes of that, and then George calls me over behind the monitors and puts his hand on my shoulder and says, oh, you did a great job, man. And I remember thinking, could someone bring one of those M16s over and put one right between my eyes because it ain't going to get any better than this.
Yeah, really.
You know, I don't need anything more after this. So that was, I still think that's pretty much the best day I ever had ever.
Cool.
You know, someone offered me, do you want a part in the latest Hollywood blockbuster or 2 seconds of a George Romero zombie movie? I get that Hollywood blockbuster out of my face. You know, George Romero, they don't get no better than that. Go away.
Yeah. Now, you're also working on Diary of the Dead.
Mm.
Tell us a little bit about what you've done with that movie.
Well, Diary of the Dead came about, George originally it's an interesting script in that it was not a continuation of the Dead mythology so far. I mean, there's never really been direct connections between all the Dead movies, but there's been a progression. You know, there's been a situation where things have gotten progressively worse as the movies have gone on for humanity. This one is sort of a reboot. It takes it back to the first night, but instead of taking it back to the first night in 1968, it imagines what would happen if the first night were right now. And we're going to follow these filmmakers who are out making this low-budget horror movie in the woods when the Dead outbreak begins to happen, and they're trying to get home or trying to get safe, and we just follow them as they try to survive over the course of the night and the next couple of days. And we're only seeing the film from the perspective of the people who are filming. So there's only one camera. This isn't shot like a traditional movie. We're seeing it through the camera of the director who's filming everything as it happens, and then they pick up another camera along the way, and so then we get footage from two different cameras, and it's very experimental and very strange. But one thing that needs to be pointed out is that this is not Blair Witch meets the zombies.
Mm-hmm.
When this project was first announced, there was some press release that went out that mentioned Blair Witch a bunch of times, and this is very different than that. This is not an ultra-realistic kind of herky-jerky style. This is a very stylized, very, you know, George has a very sardonic sense of humor, and so this whole thing is pitched at a certain level. It's almost like a comic book.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is very much that same way. So it's not shot all herky-jerky. You're not going to be spending 10 minutes in a, you know, getting ready to throw up. And it's not that I was a huge fan of Blair Witch, but this is a very different type of style, and I think it's something that people are really going to... This reminds me a lot more of his work from the 70s. It's very experimental, very avant-garde, very different. And I think true fans of his work are really going to dig this. I really think that they're going to enjoy it. But basically what ended up happening is because I'd worked with the producers before, John Harrison in particular, I convinced them to hire me to come up there and supervise all the behind-the-scenes footage. That was shot they did 4 weeks of shooting and then also a couple days of additional shooting back in the beginning of May. Mm-hmm. And then I'm also going to be, I've posted one, but they're going to do some more MySpace shorts where I'm kind of hosting some little things.
Hmm. Now, what's the status of the movie as far as like when it's being released or do you know?
Yeah, basically the movie's almost finished. They're doing the final mix on it right now. And what's going to happen, I mean, this was a completely independent film. There was no distribution deal in place when this movie was finished. So what they're going to do now is they're going to shop it around, I think, over the course of the summer to studios and see who ends up deciding to buy it. They really wanted to wait until the film was 100% done before shopping it around because it's a very strong film, but it's also the concept is such that you need to be able to see the whole thing from beginning to end to really get into the world that George has created. And I personally think the film's great. I'm really very proud of it. I think George is too. So they've got a couple more weeks of sound mixing, and then they're going to start shopping it around. So it's either going to come out, you'll start seeing it at festivals or premieres later this year, then probably come out early next year. But, I mean, again, that's just speculation on my point. I don't know. But it's they've just been taking their time really fine-tuning this in post. But it's a terrific little movie.
Back here on Dead Pit. We're going to do something a little bit different here. We don't normally stray from the horror format, but there was an incident last week that absolutely pretty much blew everybody away who's a fan of wrestling, and we wanted to talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, even not. I mean, it's just in national news. And this is just a little short segment, and then we'll get back to the normal after this. I'm sure everybody's heard about what happened last week with Chris Benoit and his family and stuff. And I just thought we should talk about it because I'm sure people are curious on the message board. We have a lot of horror wrestling fans too, you know.
Yeah, and if you haven't heard about it, okay, well, let's start at the beginning. The first time I heard anything about the story, it was just that Chris Benoit and his wife, Nancy, who was woman in WCW, and that's where they met and that whole storyline, and his son, Daniel, had all been killed. So immediately, or hadn't been killed, they had all died.
They were all found dead.
Yeah. So immediately, the rumors started and everything started, people were kind of speculating about what happened to them. And I know that one of the first rumors that I heard was that it was carbon monoxide poisoning and that they had all died in the house. And right after the news broke, WWE, which I hate saying that, but WWE actually aired a 3-hour tribute to Benoit, much like the tribute they had for Owen Hart, except for there was absolutely no wrestling whatsoever. It was just...
Yeah, there was no people. They were in the arena. There was nobody in the... There were no fans in the arena. All the seats were empty. And it was a really awesome tribute show, okay? But then you get... Hours later, you find out what happened exactly. And I honestly think, like a lot of people say, a lot of bad shit about Vince McMahon and... I know in my heart that they didn't know. They had no idea what the hell happened. Had they known, I'm sure they would probably have just went on with the show or completely canceled the show and just aired, an old pay-per-view or something.
Yeah.
There's not for 1 second did I think that they knew that he killed his family and killed himself, and then they go ahead and do a tribute to him. There's no way. And proof of that is if you go on their website, they've completely, erased Chris Benoit.
Yeah, and that's the main thing we were going to talk about, because after it was, everything was found out that he killed his wife and his son, and pretty much in one of the most brutal ways you can imagine, by strangling them both to death.
And they still don't know exactly what he did to the kid. I've heard two different things, that he, put a plastic bag over his head, or that he got him in a chokehold.
Yeah, that there was some kind of wrestling choke or something. And immediately... You're trying to figure out, first of all, what the hell was going on. I've been trying to figure out that.
Yeah.
What actually precipitated somebody murdering their whole family within a course of 3 days? Because he didn't do it just at one time, apparently.
Yeah,
over a course of at least 2 days.
That's the sick thing about it. There was a long amount of time where he was in the house with those bodies. And that you know, we always talk about horror movies on here, fiction and stuff. Nobody could write something like this. I mean, this is some of the sickest stuff I've ever heard.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this is, you know, long lines like stuff John Wayne Gacy would do, you know. Or the thing that's so weird about it is Chris Benoit, one of the most well-respected wrestlers among, like, wrestling fans and, like, the wrestlers themselves. I mean, you would never hear one person say a bad thing about Chris Benoit when he was alive. And for something like this to happen, and especially to somebody, you know, somebody like Chris Benoit, you'd never, ever thought somebody like that would do something that drastic.
Chris Benoit was never known as, you know, backstage as being the kind of person that flies off the handle. He didn't have that type of reputation.
He stayed to himself.
Yeah, now other people had that type of reputation. You know, people like Randy Orton who are batshit crazy behind the scenes.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't. He didn't.
Drugs and everything.
Benoit never caused any problems. He never had fights backstage. Always well respected, and that makes it even more bizarre because you think you know these people, and his best friends. Imagine what his best friends like, Chavo Guerrero.
And if you watch that tribute, it's pretty obvious that a lot of those people thought really, really highly of him and would never imagine that to be the case. But immediately, though, here's the part of the story that gets kind of awkward, I guess, is that immediately the media starts talking about steroids.
Yeah.
Because that's what the media does. Anytime anybody brings up a wrestler, that's exactly what happens all the time.
Right.
This doesn't seem like it was the type of case of like roid rage or anything like that because of the way it was premeditated for one thing, and for another thing, he did it like we said over a course of a period of time.
Another thing we can mention too is he late on the Saturday night before he killed himself, he sent out these series of really strange text messages, and where he was basically telling his physical address. He lived in Georgia. Giving his address, saying the side door was open, the dogs are in the front yard area or something like that. Basically, telling the people where they can find the bodies, pretty much. So this wasn't an act of rage at all. But I think the thing that a lot of people aren't looking at in the media, and, you know, it just goes to show you how much research those motherfuckers do, is the overall, not just the roids. Okay, the roids is probably part of it. But the travel, the injuries, you know, all that stuff combined. Because these guys, they travel more than any professional athlete going. I mean, there's nobody that travels that much.
Well, it's,
In addition to that, to try to keep themselves in shape because these guys have to look like a million bucks every time they're on TV. And except for Viscera. He's exempt from that. He'll live forever.
Just because he's bigger than a fucking couch. But the thing is, it was a combination of things, I think. It was the stress of the situation that he was under, plus he had to be fucking, like, volatile anyway. Because all those guys are under the same amount of stress, but it's something within that situation caused him to do that. And we'll probably never find out what exactly that was. But here's the main thing that I want to talk about, though. I understand that WWE is trying to erase, like, everything that has anything to do with Chris Benoit. But the fact of the matter is, it's not really possible to do that. If anybody has seen any of these pay-per-views that he was in, you know that, for instance, he was the main event, one of the guys in the main event of WrestleMania 20.
He won WrestleMania.
Yeah, if you erase that from the box, or you take his name off of the... It doesn't really change the fact that Chris Benoit was in it.
Yeah.
It doesn't change anything. I know it was a horrible situation, and I personally wouldn't take a piss on Chris Benoit's grave right now, because I can't condone any of that shit.
Yeah.
But the fact is that it's almost like trying to cover up the Holocaust or something. It's happened.
Well, I think what they want to do is they want to, at least for the time being when this is really, really out there in the mainstream news and stuff, they want to try to distance themselves as much as possible from Chris Benoit. And that's pretty understandable because they're taking a lot of shit, you know. And I think they probably deserve to take a lot of shit because, you know,
Chris Benoit deserves to take a lot of shit. Those other guys in there don't deserve to be punished because one fucking guy goes psychopathic, okay? All those guys do exactly the same things Chris Benoit does. They travel the same amount of time and they do the same amount of work.
Well, the Chris Benoit thing is... Yeah, but this is bringing up all the deaths related to wrestling again. This is the chance where you can have somebody on there and do something about it, because these guys, more of these guys are going to die, maybe not kill themselves. More of these guys are going to have, you know, heart failure, strokes, whatever goes, because they do too much, man. I mean, it's just a vicious cycle.
I think that, one of the complaints that Vince McMahon receives the most is that he doesn't take care of his wrestlers, and that anytime anybody has a problem, they just immediately get fired. He doesn't ever try to really help anybody out. I'm not entirely sure if that's true or not, but it seems to me like that from what I've heard about these wrestlers, there is no real, if they have any kind of emotional problems or any kind of psychological problems, there's not really any place they can go. I mean, they pretty much deal with it themselves. And eventually, if you are under that much stress for that long a period of time, some shit like this will, maybe, I never would imagine something like this would happen, but I can see, like, domestic abuse and stuff like that happening under situations like this.
Yeah. It's just really, you know, what's unfortunate is Chris Benoit was seriously one of our favorites to watch in the ring.
Yeah.
And I love all those matches he had, Eddie Guerrero, Dean Malenko, and, you know, Kurt Angle a few years ago. You can't look back at that now. Like, think of that. I mean, I can't think of Chris, because we've met Chris Benoit.
Anytime you ever see a match with Chris Benoit, you're never going to be thinking about that he was an amazing technical wrestler. You're going to be thinking about
that
as a murderer.
To me, that fucking sucks.
Yeah.
Because I love wrestling. I love watching wrestling. We've both been wrestling fans for as long as, you know, we've watched horror movies. So it sucks for the wrestling fans, and it sucks for the wrestlers that have to deal with this. And I just hated it, man. I can't stop thinking about, you know, every day I've thought about it since it happened.
Here's the thing. Why we're doing this is because it affected us a lot. And aside from horror, this wrestling is probably our other favorite kind of thing to watch. And, yeah, it's completely changed the whole dynamics of wrestling forever now. I don't think I'll ever be able to turn on and watch wrestling the same way I did before this happened. It's always going to be there. It's going to be the marker which everything else is measured to when people do something wrong in wrestling.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a lot of bad stuff in wrestling, but I've never seen anything that was remotely, you know, like this, anything close. Because we were watching the pay-per-view where Owen Hart died.
Yeah.
And that you know, that was fucked up. But fuck, to read on the internet that Chris Benoit killed his wife on a Friday, killed his son on that Saturday morning, and killed himself, you know, on early Sunday, whenever it was, and premeditated it all. I mean, that's just, you would never think of anybody doing that. I wouldn't think of any wrestler being that sick, let alone somebody that was evidently very well loved by the wrestling community and wrestlers, and he was highly respected.
Yeah, stuff starts.
It's really scary. That's a really scary thing to talk about. You know,
stuff starts
about.
To come out now about they were injecting his son with human growth hormones and stuff like that because they thought he was too small or he had some kind of dwarfism or something like that.
Yeah.
Shit just gets more bizarre. For every story that comes out, it just gets more and more bizarre. So I don't know what's going to eventually come out. We might one day figure out what set him off or what, you know, event kind of precipitated this, but I doubt it. But
yeah.
In any regard, I can't really say anything positive about Chris Benoit's death, but I can just offer condolences to him. Doesn't he have two other sons aside from the condolences to them and their other family members, because it's truly one of the most fucked up things I've ever heard.
It is. And, it's going to take wrestling a long fucking time to get over this, if ever. You know, I mean, something like this happens, you don't get over it overnight, you know. Like, when Eddie Guerrero died, yeah, it was sad. And I hated that it happened because he was another one of our favorite wrestlers. But my God, you know, something like this, there's no words really to describe what I felt when I learned that. That's all I got to say. So, I guess we can take another break and get back into the show.
Yeah.
Back into some lighter subjects like, what some of your favorite upcoming DVDs this year? What are you most looking forward to? I think that's the topic tonight.
Yeah, but keep in mind when you're listening to this show that a lot of people give horror movies and stuff a lot of shit, but this kind of stuff is a far cry from anything like what happens in real life. And a lot of the reason why we watch this stuff is to escape from having to hear about shit like this that happens. And the real tragedies are always the tragedies that happen to real people. And horror movies are just entertainment.
Indeed. So we'll be back in a second on
DeadBit.com.
Hi, this is Lucky McKee, director of May, and you're listening to DeadBit Radio.
They were parked in the woods on a summer night. They had been warned not to come here. No one is safe in this place at night. For God's sake, why don't they run while they can still get away? It's almost too late. There's something moving toward them, and the nightmare is beginning. Madman, rated R.
Hello, folks, and welcome back to Dead Pit. We, once again, I apologize to horror fans for, you know, not talking horror last segment, I guess. Mm-hmm. But that's something I think that we both needed to talk about, because I'm sure people, we've received a ton of emails, people want to know what we think about it, so we might as well just talk about it then. So there's that. Now, we're going to answer some fan mail and some fan questions. Hello, you're on Dead Pit.
Hey, yeah, this is John L1 from Ohio.
What's going on, man? Did you just hook up some Skype?
The El Horn. Yeah.
Just got some Skype, man. It's good stuff.
Cool. So what's going on, man? What's some of your favorite DVDs this year that you're looking forward to or whatever?
Well, I figured everybody else was going to talk about the big three, but there was one that's coming out that I'm really excited about. The remake, the 1978 remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers is coming out. It's got Donald Sutherland and Leonard Nimoy and whatnot in it.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
That's being re-released for like the third time, I think.
Yeah, well, I hadn't seen it, or I'd never, if it did come out before, and it may have, I didn't realize that, but I had missed those, so I was pretty psyched to see that it was coming out, and it's coming out, I guess, a special edition with a bunch of extras.
Cool. Yeah, there's another one, I think we got it for like $4.88 a couple years ago, wasn't it? That was Invasion of Body Snatchers, wasn't it?
Did we get that one?
I believe
yeah,
so.
Yeah, we did, yeah, that's right.
That's why
really?
I haven't.
Yeah, I didn't realize it had been out.
It was one of the Walmart ones. There was a time around Halloween where they released like a ton of titles for $4.88, and I think it was a lot of MGM stuff, and yeah, cool. That happened to be one of them.
Well, my bad, but I was excited about it coming out.
Well, yeah, I think it's the first time it's probably coming out with extras and stuff, though, so yeah, that's always cool.
Yep, big time.
It's the one cool thing that comes out of all these remakes is usually the original film or, you know, a classic version of the film. I guess that was a remake, too, but it always gets, like, a special edition, usually.
Yeah, I'm always kind of curious to see if, like, with Prom Night, if with the remake of Prom Night, they'll actually put out a decent edition of that DVD.
Yeah, man, I was real disappointed in the one I got. It kind of sucked. You couldn't even see the picture in a lot of it.
Yeah, what is the company that released that one? Do you know?
I don't remember. It was some shitty thing I got for like $4. Somewhere.
Yeah, I know. I remember I got that one at Walmart, too, and it was a really fucking bad
Platinum
transfer.
Platinum Disc Company or something.
You know what really sucks, though, is I have a copy of it on VHS, and it's actually got a better picture on the VHS than it did on the DVD.
It looks like they took it directly from a VHS, like a third-generation VHS.
I've got the old-school Laserdisc Disco Vision copy. So.
Disco Vision?
Yeah.
Disco Vision?
Like in the 70s, they would have these... a couple of these DVDs. I know the Prom Night's one of them. I know there's a few more that were Disco Vision editions on Laserdisc. No real special features or anything. It's just, I don't know, I guess that was a little name they were using or something. So
is there anything else going on, though, aside from horror DVD releases you might want to talk about?
Well, I just, not really. I just thought I'd call it stay on topic.
Okay.
I don't want Adam Beck to get pissed off.
Adam Beck gets pissed off at everything.
I guess that's true.
Yeah. Pissed off people breathing.
Well, man, thanks for calling and call back whenever. It's always great to hear from you.
I will. All right. You're my first official Skype call, so.
Cool. Well, it sounds pretty good.
Yeah,
so.
It does.
Thanks. Take it easy.
Take care.
See you, man.
Bye.
Yeah, Skype actually does sound so much more clear. If people actually out there want to use Skype and it's completely free, you can Skype us at the username DeadPit. That's how that works. So let's get into a fan question real quick. What do you got, Uncle Bill?
And this is from a new member of the board, Orion Jericho, who writes in and says, I've worked up enough bravado with my liquid courage to actually ask a rather simple question I hope you can address. Are either of you familiar with Jose Mojica Marin, a.k.a. Coffin Joe, Brazilian filmmaker from the 60s and 70s who helmed such classics as At Midnight I'll Take Your Soul and This Night I Will Possess Your Corpse? Totally transgressive cinema for its time, and I find it often overlooked. If not, I would highly recommend it.
Yeah. I've heard of the guy. I've definitely heard of the name Coffin Joe. I've never seen any of the films, but sooner or later, I'm sure we'll get a review.
Sooner or later, we see everything. Yeah. I think that's the case anyway. But, yeah, Coffin Joe is definitely one I've heard. And somebody released one of those movies. I don't remember who it was exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
Cool. Okay, we've got a question here from Bethany D., who wants to know, have you guys heard anything about the Dead Pit fan gathering at Fright Night? I know I asked a while back, and CK was waiting on an answer from some guy. I don't remember. Okay. Yeah, we talked about this some a little bit on the MySpace show. What we have planned. What do you want to talk about a little bit? We've got a lot of stuff planned, actually.
Yeah, here's what we got planned. We're going to, aside from the fact that we've actually got a special Dead Pit screening, which is going to be where we show, I think, 2 to 3 films of our choosing. Anybody that wants to come, fans of the Dead Pit show, are more than welcome to come. We're going to show a couple movies. Haven't figured out what those movies are going to be yet. But aside from doing that and from actually being at the show, and we might actually do some kind of panel or something, I don't know, it's hard to say, we're going to have a couple of other things. We're going to have the Kentucky Junior Opera Pro Cloggers down there.
Right.
And they're going to be doing their special clogger rendition of Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
And I think on Saturday, we're going to have a special guest, Jesco White, the Dancing Outlaw. He's going to do some tap dancing along with the Junior Pro Cloggers. So
that's true. Cool. And then we're going to have Elroy Compton, who's a banjo soloist, and he's going to be playing a lot of the horror themes from the different show for the different films that are going to be at the show. And, yeah, he's going to be soloing that out for us.
Yeah, and in addition to that, we got a lot of stuff. Okay, we're going to have a KFC fried chicken eat-off.
Right.
Where the winner actually wins, you know, a lifetime supply of KFC.
And, of course,
grease.
All throughout the weekend, if you stop by the Dead Pit booth, we've got the free anal raping that's going to be going on all weekend. And that's just how we are, you know. It's deliverance-style anal raping with whatever, you know, sub-fetish you'd like to throw
in. We've got a ton of stuff.
We do.
You know, so that's just a little bit
of
what we have planned.
You know, come for the horror, but stay for the anal rape. That's what I always say.
Yeah. Speaking of anal raping, hello, you're on Dead Pit Radio. Who's this?
What's going on, guys? Is this the Doodlesons?
This is James, yeah.
Yeah, what's going on, man? I'm just hanging out with Anthony Tapone. I got me a tattoo penciled onto my arm.
Oh, did you?
Oh, yeah. I was hanging out with him,
hardcore.
Too. I just took a big shit.
Yeah, I sure did. It was awesome. It was hot.
Cool.
What's going on, gentlemen?
Not too much, man. We're talking about what your favorite DVD is, what DVD you're looking forward to the most that's coming out this year.
It would definitely be a Monster Squad, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Has everybody already mentioned that one?
No, actually, this is the second call, and you're the first one to mention it.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah,
I was going to say, this was, that's definitely the first thing I thought of, is just Monster Squad. I'm just, for all of us guys who just loved it for the last 20 years, that's without a doubt the best one.
And, you have to love the fact that they got all those people together at a convention to do the commentary and just all the special features that, and we were talking to Michael Felcher about all the stuff that he set up to do with that disc.
Uh-huh.
It's going to be a pretty amazing disc.
I think so. I mean, like, I just saw the information on it last week or two, like all the stuff they've added to the disc, and it's going to be just fantastic. So
yeah, I mean,
would say that's like one of my favorites to see that. That and probably From Beyond.
Oh, yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to that.
So I'm looking forward to that. I saw the artwork. That looks a little crappy, but, you know.
Well, all the new artwork for some reason looks pretty bad.
If you've seen the Return of Living Dead artwork, it looks like pure shit, too.
Yeah, that kind of thing, that's true. But, yeah, those two discs, I think, are probably high on my list of anticipation. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about the Monster Squad is this is the very first time it's been available in the U.S. since its first video release. So it's been 20 years in the making, and it's pretty amazing that the film has the following it does, because all of these other movies, like From Beyond, I think it at least had a special edition Laserdisc that was out.
Right, right.
Whereas Monster Squad, I mean, they just had
the
initial.
Well, the thing about Monster Squad is it got fucking repetitively played on HBO back in the day because I know right. for a fact I've seen it a dozen times on there. But, yeah, and From Beyond, I'm really looking forward to that because I think they're going to include a lot of the uncut scenes that Stuart Gordon had to take out, including the one that everybody always talks about with the eyeball, sucking the brain through the eyeballs.
Yeah, I think it's going to be, I think both of them will probably be like what the fans want to see. You know, they're really going to do it all out. I'm pretty pumped about those two.
So did you hear us talk about like the one of the things that we're going to do special for the Fright Night Fest?
No, I know you said something about you've been talking to Ken about maybe having like a special night maybe where we can go watch some Dead Pit,
screening.
I think we've got that, yeah.
Yeah, that's what we were talking about. We have at least enough time to do two movies, I think, on Saturday night.
On Friday night?
I think it's Saturday night. We're gonna
Saturday night, awesome. That'd be great, man. That'd be awesome. Have you all picked out the movies yet?
No.
No, I mean, what do you think?
We're open for suggestions, yeah.
Are we able to watch whatever? Is this like a DVD thing? We're just going to put it up and watch it?
It'll be just like
be like any other screen they'd have at a convention, yeah.
Right, cool. I personally would try to think it'd be cool. I think it would be cool if some of the guys want to get together and try to see something that none of us have really seen, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That'd be hard to fucking do, wouldn't it?
But like some stuff that people haven't seen a lot of, you know, some of us guys, because, like, for instance, I haven't seen a lot of the Italian stuff, like a lot of that. I haven't seen a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so for me, it'd be kind of cool to see something like that, because I haven't seen much of it, and you guys can, like, you know, edumacate me on all this from my perspective. But
we definitely have a lot of the Italian stuff.
Yeah, that'd be kind of cool. I think that'd be fun. But, you know, of course.
Troll 2.
I'm all for watching something like Grizzly or Day of the Animals.
I'm sure that.
Yeah, I think that would be kind of fun because, you know, it's Louisville. He's from Louisville, you know, and all that. That would be kind of neat, but, you know, from that perspective. But honestly, just hanging out with you guys will be fun enough with everybody. Just, I think whatever we do will be a good time.
Cool. Well, man, we're going to let you go. I mean, we've been on here a while.
All right,
man.
Well, thanks for shooting the breeze with me, and I'll catch you so tomorrow. And I can't wait to see you guys here in a couple weeks, man.
All right.
Yeah, we're definitely looking forward to it.
Take it easy,
man. Good times.
Okay.
See you,
all right, man. Take care, guys.
See you.
See you. Bye-bye.
It was a lengthy conversation with Jason Payne.
And this is going to be an even lengthier fucking email here, apparently.
All right.
Okay, here we go. It says, hi there, I'm new on the board. Name's Matt from Iowa. I apologize for the length of the post. I'm getting through your archives, and it's entertaining as hell. Here we go. First question, CK, glad to hear you thought Jacob's Ladder was creepy as hell. Thanks once again for sending me an email back. It still creeps the shit out of me. I love the film and think it's criminally underrated. I was wondering if you could elaborate your thoughts on it, and also if Uncle Bill saw it. If so, what does he think of it?
Yeah, I've only seen the movie once, because you brought it down here.
I'm the one that brought it, and you asked me.
just the atmosphere is what made that movie creepy to me. It wasn't any particular thing that happened in it. It was just the way it was shot. I think.
Yeah, as far as me, I've seen the film probably two or three times at least, and it's just one of those films that makes you feel like you're trapped in a box or something. I don't know how else to explain it. It's really, really surreal film to try to sit and watch, and you do think about it a lot after you get done watching it, so I really liked it. Yeah. So the second part of the question is, I enjoyed April Fool's Day, but most people get pissed by the ending, although I loved it. In fact, in the Going to Pieces documentary, I think they said that April Fool's Day harmed the slasher genre. Yeah, they did say that. I disagree and think it's a damn good underrated slasher. What's your thoughts on the film? Did it harm slashers, and were you pissed the first time you saw the ending?
Well, the first time I saw the ending, I don't even remember. I was a kid. I was a little kid, so I couldn't answer you that.
I saw the ending, I was a kid, too, and I was fucking confused. I know that. Now, yeah, in retrospect, though, when I see it now, I think it was a hell of an ingenious idea.
It was, because it made it different, for one thing. Now, people got to understand here, this was around a time frame, literally hundreds of these movies came out every year, slasher movies. Now, that's what killed the slasher genre. Just oversaturation, I think.
Yeah, it got to the point where there was just so many generic titles that people couldn't differentiate any of them from, you know, one from the last one that came out, and that's probably what hurt it more.
I mean, I can tell you from the past 7 or 8 years, me and you have tried to watch every slasher movie made. We've tried, and we've experienced a lot of horrible fucking movies over that, too. It's amazing how many types of slasher films were released during like the 80s. So.
And keep in mind that the guy that says that in the Going to Pieces documentary was that same guy that we were both talking about. It's a big douchebag that always goes on like he knows everything about the genre. It's like walking the bald-headed guy.
Yeah.
Anyway.
We got a caller. We'll finish the rest of these questions after the caller. How about that?
Hey, this is Dead Pit Radio. Who's this?
Hey, it's Cowboy.
Hey.
Hey, man.
What's going on?
Not much.
We were actually just talking about, like, we got a question about what we think killed the slasher genre. If April Fool's Day killed the slasher genre. And I was like, no, what killed the slasher genre is because there were hundreds of fucking slashers that came out in the 80s.
Oh, yeah, I agree with that. Just way too many. I mean, still to this day, I'm finding ones, you know, like, not even like one or two, like five or six a week that I haven't seen yet.
Yeah.
I just think there's more or less way too many for anybody to see. And I mean, it's kind of like what's going on now, I think. It's just way too many movies of, you know, any genre. It just seems like, you know, there's like a handful each week that are released.
I just actually found a website that's called hysterialives.co.uk that's simply dedicated to slasher films in like certain eras of the 80s.
Yeah.
And there's shit on there that I never even knew existed. I mean, up to that point.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, like every day, and I want to watch every movie too. And unfortunately, when I do get them, I'm a little let down because most of them suck.
Yeah,
that's true.
That's definitely true.
But anyway, we're talking about the upcoming DVD releases too. Is there any one in particular you're looking forward to?
Yeah, The Pieces. I really am excited to see that.
Is that the Grindhouse releasing
version?
Yeah, those guys have been working on those damn films.
Well, at least finally they have the cover art, at least. I've heard about Pieces for years that they were going to release that.
But I guess it's really happening now, hopefully. But
I don't know if you've... I'm sure you probably do have that DVD. I think there's a Brentwood 10-pack with that on there.
Yeah, the one I have, it's in a slim case. It's from a box set. I'm not even sure what it's from. But, I do have that copy of it. And then I have the VHS version of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've got one from, like, the Bloodbath... some kind of maybe 5-pack, 3-pack. I can't remember exactly what it is. I know Brent would put it out, but it's a horrible transfer, I'll say that.
I know, though.
The one I have is pretty bad.
A lot of the Grindhouse releases, for some reason, they take forever. Like the Cannibal Holocaust release, I mean, how many years in the making was that?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they've got the other one, what is it, an American Hippie in Israel or something like that?
I don't know.
That they've been working on forever?
Yeah, well, hopefully it's worth it because hopefully, you know, it's going to have a really nice transfer and a lot of good extras, but I, you know, who knows.
That's a film that I can't believe we didn't include that in the Best of the Bad, but it definitely deserves to be in there.
Yeah, that's one that I've actually not seen, believe it or not.
Yeah, I think the ending is at least in the top five best slasher endings, I think. It's hilarious.
Yeah, you to try and explain that to somebody would be almost impossible, too.
Yeah.
Because it's so freaking just, it's out there, bizarre. But I didn't know they made blue jeans that melted away, so that's all I'll say about it.
Cool. I guess we can tell people, though, that you're reviewing a ton of these old VHS movies. You've got any lined up for us? New ones?
I just put one up today that I finished. I had to watch it all over again called, I forgot the name of it.
I do that a lot.
Sledgehammer. Yeah, Sledgehammer.
Okay.
It's a shot on VHS movie from 1983 that was just completely horrible. and I have a stack of them I really want to review, and I guess that and I don't know. But that's the last one I did, and I don't even know why I tried to watch it again.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to review some of them on there that I know a lot of people don't know about, like...
The Love Butcher.
Well, The Love Butcher is one that we started watching. And Home Sweet Home is... Didn't you think there was a lot of shots stolen? Well, I don't know, homage and Thanksgiving from Home Sweet Home?
I think so, but... I guess it depends on who you ask, if you know.
Like,
I would say yes.
To steal shit from that movie, you have to be a pretty sad motherfucker. I'll say it. But the thing about it is...
It's pretty cool, though.
I swear to God, I can remember that after we watched Grindhouse and that Thanksgiving trailer, and then we saw Home Sweet Home right after that, there were direct shots lifted out of that thing.
Well, one shot I remember...
I have to, I would have to go back and look again, but I agree. I think it is, and I think when people steal, maybe he thought no one would ever watch this movie.
Yeah, he probably did about that. You know, the majority of people. There was one shot though where the killer run over the granny in the street or whatever, there's a shot exactly like it was like a zoom in on her face or whatever, she's screaming. Yeah. That's in Thanksgiving, exactly that exact shot. So.
Yeah, and now that you mention it, I actually completely agree on that one.
Yeah. Anyway. But thanks for calling. It's great talking to you. I think it's the first time you've called, right?
Yeah, I tried to get through a few times, but I'm always at work, so it's really hard. But, yeah, it's no problem.
Cool. All right, man. Thanks for doing the reviews, too.
That's no problem. Talk to you guys later.
All right, take it easy. It's the Scab Boy.
And his VHS collection is one of the most amazing things I've seen, actually, as far as slasher titles go.
Yeah. I mean, if you go on his website, scabboy.net, I think he's got like 1,000 movies on there. So a lot of them are VHS.
So, okay, we're at number three here. He says, I realize that there are a lot of nature or animal run-amuck films. There's Grizzly, Cujo, Strays, about killer fucking cats, Squirm, Frogs, and of course Jaws and the Birds. In fact, there's the fucking Trees, the movie.
I don't see that one.
They took Jaws and remade it, but instead of the Great White Shark, it's the Great White Pine. They got a trailer for it on YouTube, and holy shit, balls of fire, it's dumb. My question is, first, have you ever heard of this film? And two, any thoughts on doing a segment on these type of films like you did with zombie films on the May 18th edition? Like, I guess he's talking about killer nature films.
What did we do on the May 18th edition? We didn't have, I don't even remember.
Zombie films? Did we do something on zombies? It's talking about Fulci?
I don't know. I can't remember that far back. Usually I don't like these or evil animal movies. I don't know what it is.
A lot of them are, yeah, just really disappointing.
There's another one that Synapse released a few years ago called The Long Weekend. And it's okay, but I just don't like that type of movie. I know that movie has a huge following. It was an Australian film, and I'm not big on those movies, honestly.
I have to say I really did like Grizzly, though, and I actually liked Night of the Lepus, which is Killer Rabbit's movie.
Well, Grizzly is just hilarious.
It is.
There's some scenes, because I actually did finally watch that again a couple of weeks ago, and there's just scenes in it that's so goddamn funny. And you've mentioned it before where you never really see the bear. They show like far away shots of a grizzly bear and that's it. Then you see just this, it's obviously like this guy's got like a claw on a stick and he just swats these
people. Yeah, from behind the camera, they just swat in a big paw of what's supposed to be a bear and it whacks people's limbs off and stuff. That's the greatest part about the movie, I think.
Yeah.
But okay, here's the fourth part of the question.
God, this is
in your opinion, it's like an ASA. In your opinion, do you think they'll ever have a special edition DVD of the Blob remake? Maybe it's just me. There's DVD, but I think that the great '80s monster movie deserves a better DVD. They have a special edition of John Carpenter's The Thing, The Fly remake, even the '50s version of the Blob, and yet done for this. Just want to know your thoughts on this. I know if you listen to the interview, actually Michael Felcher talks about that.
Yeah, I don't know which part it'll be in. It's one of those parts.
But we actually ask him, or he actually, I think he brings that up himself about the possibility of a Blob.
I don't know if there ever will be a Blob remake special edition, though. That's just one of those movies it wasn't that big of a success when it came out.
I think that if it was, it'd just be because of like Shawnee Smith or something. If she keeps starring in horror movies or something, they might do it because of that. Number five. Just watched Maximum Overdrive and Graveyard Shift. Everyone else hates it, but I like this monster flick. Thought it had a good atmosphere, a cool score, and a decent monster. My two favorite Stephen King films. Just wanted to ask what top three fave King films and three worst King films.
A lot of people probably wouldn't like this because I don't know if I would pick any horror films of Stephen King.
That's true. There's a couple that I wouldn't pick in that regard.
My favorite movie or one of my favorite movies of all time is Stand By Me, which isn't a horror film. But I really liked that. That's one of those movies I just grew up on. And Shawshank Redemption is another one. And if I had to pick a horror film that Stephen King was a part of, it would probably be Carrie.
Yeah, I would say mine would probably be The Shawshank Redemption, Carrie, and I've always kind of not been a huge fan of The Shining, Kubrick's version of that film, so I couldn't put that one in there. But I'd say Christine because I thought that's a really underrated John Carpenter film, too.
Christine is a cool one, too.
Three least favorite ones, though. That's a lot easier.
Dreamcatcher is Probably the shittiest one that I've seen, Stephen King.
I'll go with Night Flyer. That's a fucking horrible movie.
Another horrible one is Secret Window. That one just came out a couple of years ago with Johnny Depp. Unbelievable how bad the ending is and just how stupid the movie. Like, have you ever seen it?
Secret Window? No, I haven't actually.
That's one of the, that's just horrible. That's one of those movies, once you see the ending on it, you never, ever want to watch it again. It's just so stupid.
One that I was really, really mad about when I saw it in theaters, too, was Sleepwalkers. I thought that was a horrible Stephen King film at that time, and I have never gone back and watched it again.
Let's see, other shitty Stephen King, one more.
Oh, God, I know what my last one would be, Thinner. The movie version of Thinner is fucking disgraceful, actually.
Thinner, shitty. What about Storm of the Century?
I don't know. I've never seen Storm of the Century.
I only watched half of it. I don't know what it is. Storm of the Century, Tommyknockers, all those are shitty like that.
Okay, so here we go to the sixth part. As we know, real life is scarier than films. You know, we were just talking about this. I was curious as to what were some of the scariest or creepiest things you've seen or been through in your own life. One creepy moment for me was in Iowa the other day. I just saw someone driving around with a skull and deer in, on the front of their car. Some definite chainsaw massacre type shit.
I'll tell you something that I really find disturbing around here, and it's really accepted around here for some reason, is there's these shows that are on, like, the public broadcasting system. I guess people know it as PBS around the country.
I think I know what you're going to say.
There's a show called Kentucky Afield, and there's certain shows where they will completely show you how to clean a deer, you know, and it's accepted around here, and to me that's just... I don't like hunting or anything like that. You know, there's no need to go out. Here's the thing I don't understand. If you have enough money to go out and buy your own food, why the fuck do you want to go out and kill animals and fucking basically mutilate them and then eat them?
You asking me? I have no fucking idea.
I don't understand that. You can go to the store and buy... You know, buy a roast, buy a steak. Whatever. You don't have to fucking go out and kill animals. And then, I just don't like that shit. And I cannot stand the fact that shit's on TV. And anytime it's on, I turn it off. That's one of the things that really, I think, is scarier than films. Is people around here
like that. One of the things I've noticed recently that they started doing that really, I think, is bizarre, even for around here, is that they have this program. It's on one of the local access channels too, where it's a public service announcement, and it's take a young kid hunting.
Yeah.
That's the service announcement. It's got a picture of a little girl with a shotgun walking into the woods with, like, her father. Now, I understand that that's considered to be something constructed to do around here, but to fucking teach a small child, like 6-7 years old,
and
to go around and learn how to use a firearm is just seems to me to be irresponsible.
Yeah, and the same show, the Kentucky Afield Show, they'll have letters and fan mail and stuff where they'll have kids holding up these deer that they've killed. And it's just unbelievable that they show stuff like this on TV. I can understand if you want to go hunting and stuff like that, I guess. I don't really understand it, but I know that people like to do that. Why do you have stuff on TV? Anybody can watch it. You could have a little kid, a little 4 or 5 year old kid, go in there and see them cutting and gutting a deer, you know. I just don't get that. I don't like that.
That's just the environment.
Hello, you're on Dead Pit. Who's this?
Oh, my God. This is Ronk Russell. I just got in first call. I just remembered to call.
Oh, well, son of a bitch. What's going on?
Nothing much, man. The topic this week is most anticipated DVDs for 2007.
That's right. Since the DVD season is upon us, I know a lot of the horror discs come out between, you know, July and October, usually.
Like, I know a lot of people are going to be talking about From Beyond, Return of the Living Dead, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I figured I'd talk about the newer stuff that's coming out that was having trouble getting distributed, like, or in theaters. I'm really interested in The Tripper.
The David Arquette? Yeah.
Yeah.
I am, too.
Putting out a couple cool things. I mean, he's going around as, like, a guy in, like, latex... Ronald Reagan.
Right. Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to that one. We've mentioned that a few times on the show. I actually wanted to see it in theaters, but I think it only had like a 50 theater run.
Yeah, it had a really, really limited release. And I actually talked to David Arquette through email and tried to get him on the show.
You're going to try to put him on the show around October when it comes out?
Maybe.
Yeah, well, he said that at the time that I got to him, he apparently had been doing like a series of radio interviews and written interviews, and he said he was just burnt out on it, but he would try to do it sometime.
Yeah, I'm sort of impressed with David Arquette because I never would have thought that he would have. I just thought that he was doing this because horror is popular now, and, you know, it's just a quick buck from him. But it seems like he really is genuinely interested in the horror genre, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah, and like with the I know you guys don't like Fangoria or whatever, but I read the article in Fangoria.
I love Fangoria. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I love him too. No, but yeah, I'm really excited about that. Along with and I hope you get this interview. I mean, I don't know if it'd be that interesting in an interview. I think companion piece to your Rob Schmidt interview. If you guys can like speak or get a written interview with Rob or with Joe Lynch for Wrong Turn 2 that Fox is also putting out.
Oh yeah.
I think because I actually think it looks good. I mean, I know it got that reality TV plot a lot of people seem to hate, especially after Halloween Resurrection.
Yeah, that's pretty much killed that subplot, didn't it?
Yeah, and I guess the last one, I mean, after watching Behind the Mask, they got that, it's more like a teaser, it's a long teaser, they don't show too much, but Hatchet looks pretty damn good.
Yeah, Hatchet is one of those films where we've talked to Adam and Green on and off again about that, but it was so messed up there for a long period of time where he didn't know who was going to distribute it and what the rating was going to be. I think he just recently got an R rating for the film. And I think we will eventually try to get him on the show, though.
And hopefully everyone could take part of that, the Hatchet Army thing that's going on. I mean, I think that's going to give the movie a nice little campaign. So, I mean, people can talk about this year ain't that good in horror, but a lot of these direct-to-DVD releases make it a much better year in horror
yeah.
than what most people are going to think it is. Because at the end of the year, a lot of these movies are going to make my top 10. Behind the Mask will, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, that was probably one of my favorite films that I've seen for a long time. As far as the way it was constructed, it's completely different.
It was real smart. I mean, it wasn't scary at all.
Yeah. But as far as DVD releases go, I don't think you're going to find a better year than this year. Because all the fucking films that everyone's always been bitching about that have not come out on DVD are
except
actually coming out. Yeah, but that film will never be out on DVD. I don't.
You really, hey man, did you really think Monster Squad, after all the bitching that was going on this year, I mean, like a couple months, what was it, in April that was, or May, that was brought up by Don May?
Yeah.
Oh man, I mean.
Yeah, I seriously shit myself when he said that.
We're going to be seeing Monster Squad on DVD within a month.
Mm-hmm.
Well, man, we got some more fan questions to get to, but thanks for calling. I think you're going to be our last caller tonight because, you know, we're running a little late.
All right, man. Well, I'm glad I called in and I actually got in. I almost forgot. But, yeah, thanks for having topics like this everywhere.
Cool.
Keeps it fresh and brand new. All right,
man. Take it easy.
Take care, man.
Yeah, we're going to have to close the phone lines, I guess. We'll never get all these questions in. But,
Yeah, that's basically the last part of that question, though. And that comes to us from Matt from Iowa, who's a Rambo fan on the message board.
This one's from L. Juan, who we just talked to.
That's right.
Damn, you guys are getting too freaking popular. I couldn't get through last week, and I had a couple of great crappy movies to talk about. Have you guys seen either of the John Bud Cardos-directed classics, Kingdom of the Spiders, which is Tarantulas versus William Shatner's overacting, or Mutant, starring Wings Hauser in a movie that is inspired by Night of the Living Dead? Unfortunately, I haven't seen either of those movies.
I've seen Kingdom of the Spiders, but it's been probably since I was about 8 years old that I saw that film, and the only thing I can remember about it is a lot of William Shatner screaming and some tarantulas. That's all.
Yeah, so that's that. And Mutant, I haven't seen that. I haven't even heard of it, but we're not going to see all these movies, unfortunately. But if
I would like to see Kingdom of the Spiders again, or Kingdom of Spiders again, just because it was one of those so bad it might be good kind of film.
Right.
Last question I've got on here is from Joe WJ. He says, last week you did your Best of the Worst 2 show. I was just wondering if any of you have seen The Dark Power. If you can find it, you might like it because of the cheesy effects and bad acting. Basically, it's about a group of sorority girls moving to a home which was built over the graves of four Indian sorcerers. The most memorable scene is when one of the Indians sticks his thumb inside one guy's mouth and completely stretches his face.
His thumb up his butthole.
His face over his skull. Funny as hell. I don't think I've ever seen that. I think I'd remember that.
I haven't seen that one either.
Second part of the question, have you heard any news about the Thing remake or prequel or sequel or something? Last I heard, they were talking about doing a prequel. I also heard that the Sci-Fi Network was involved.
I haven't heard anything about it for a while. You?
Yeah, I couldn't even tell you last time I heard anything about that. Hopefully they won't do it, but yeah, that means they probably will. And the third part, any chance of getting an interview with someone involved with the movies Black Sheep and Hatchet? Well, we're talking about this a little bit earlier. I would like to get an interview with Adam Green. I think that's a real possibility when that movie gets closer to being released.
Yeah.
As far
and,
the guy from Black Sheep is in New Zealand, so I don't know how much of an interview that possibility that would be.
You know, something that we could do, we could at least try, I don't know if it'll work, is since Friday the 13th is coming up in a couple of weeks, possibly trying to get Kane Hodder on the show.
Yeah. I mean, that's always a possibility.
And that would be something you could ask him about Hatchet there. And I've got finally got the DVD of Ed Gein, The Butcher of Plainfield. We can ask him about that. Possibly. I don't know about Kane Hodder. I mean, he's one that we've been holding off on getting for a while. Maybe we can get him. Who knows? So, yeah.
That pretty much wraps up all the questions.
That wraps it up. And sorry we couldn't take more phone calls. We'll take 4 or 5. Had a lot of lengthy conversations this week, though, and it happens like that sometimes. So thanks for calling. Call in next week, Thursdays, 8 p.m., 1-606-658-0185. And Skype us if you have the Skype program.
Skype the shit out of us.
Username Deadbit.
I want you to Skype the shit out of me.
I want you to do it right now, buddy.
So we're going to take another break, and we have the DVDs to get to. We're going to review some DVDs, talk about a bunch of new stuff that's on the side again, because we do that. We're like that. That's just how we roll. We're going to introduce some people to Lady Cadaver this week.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Talk about that.
You're never going to be the same after you hang out with Lady Cadaver.
Yeah. So, right after the break, you're on
deadbitch.com.
On October 26th through 28th, it is...
It Came from Lake Michigan.
Wisconsin's only horror film festival is now accepting submissions from filmmakers and screenwriters in the following categories:
horror,
science fiction,
and fantasy.
Available in feature length, shorts, and screenplays. Go to
itcamefromlakemichigan.com
for more details, and keep repeating,
it's only a film festival. It's only a film festival. It's only a film festival.
Hello, folks, and welcome back to Dead Pit Radio. I'm the Creepy Kentucky.
And I'm Uncle Bill. I'd
like to thank everybody for participating in one hell of an active call-in portion. There's a ton of people that called, and we couldn't get you on. We apologize for that, but, hey, we talk to the fans that get on in length, so keep trying.
Yeah, that's always the best way to do it, is just talk to a couple people for long amounts of time instead of, like, trying to talk to 10 or 12 people one day.
I think so, too. I honestly do. And I know that some people... Yeah, you know, want to get on badly, keep trying. That's all you can say.
And Bethany D, what the hell's wrong with you? You're always going on about you trying to call in the show. I don't believe it.
I don't believe it either.
Nobody calls that much. If you called every week, you'd have to get in at one time. We got a call from Scab Boy today.
We did.
So let's do some reviews then.
Let's do some reviews. And we got some pretty cool stuff to talk about towards the end. But, yeah, let's get on some DVDs. What do we have here, Uncle Bill?
I guess the first one we can talk about right off the bat is one that I don't think any company sent us. I just think that Jay Reel actually sent you this.
Yeah, the real deal himself, Jay Reel, sent this to us. And on occasion, we do get some fans of the show. Just send us the DVDs if we are curious about them. We mentioned that we're curious about them, and he's one of them. We appreciate him sending it. It's from like 1959. Ray Kellogg, who only made a few films, and he made this movie and The Killer Shrews,
which were originally supposed to be back-to-back releases, I believe. Supposed to be like a double feature at that time. And both these films were made in Texas, I believe. They were the only two films, or one of the only... couple of films from around that time that were independent little Texas made films that actually got picked up for mainstream release, and they were shown all over the country.
Yeah, and there were a lot of monster-type movies like this, and this is really pretty fucking hilarious how they put this together.
I'm not sure if we even said the title of it yet, but it's the Giant Gila Monster.
It's the Giant Gila Monster.
Yeah, we just assume you knew that it was the Giant Gila Monster. But, so basically it's the story of a small Texas town that comes under attack by this giant radiated, mutated Gila Monster.
Gila Monster.
Which is not actually a Gila Monster. It's some other type of lizard, I think.
Yeah, you can actually go on IMDb, and what's funny is the lizard they use in the movie isn't even a Gila Monster, which I thought was pretty cool. Another really funny aspect of the movie is, I guess the lead guy, whose name is Chase Winstead in this, who everybody in the movie assumes, or we're meant to assume that he's like a, you know, just your outgoing sort that everybody in the town loves, and that he's going to become like the next big musical
sensation.
It's like
Buddy Holly or something.
Yeah. And there's a couple of scenes in this movie, and he sings one of these songs a couple of times, which is like Jesus says, "Laugh, children, laugh," or something like that. And I couldn't help but I did laugh when I saw that.
There's a whole big scene toward the middle of the movie where they have this big, like, I guess it's some kind of, what they call it, sock hops or something like that, where they get a bunch of people together and they have, like, this DJ who was an actual DJ in and around Texas, from what I read, come in and he's, like, spinning records and is going to be on the radio, and this guy's got a new record out, and he has him perform in front of this whole crowd of people, and that's when he sings those songs. It's like the big build-up for his, you know, smash hit single turns out to be this big song about Jesus making you happy, and it's just bizarre. It's one of those just really bizarre.
And he has like this little ukulele banjo type thing that he plays it on, which is even funnier. And but the big thing always is that people talk about this movie is the way they did the Gila Monster, which they just made like a bunch of small sets, which they use like a lot of camera tricks that these monster movies used back then, where they would have, like, they had a train set where it was just, it was just a fucking train set that you would buy, like.
Yeah, it's like a Lionel train set or something that they just threw a big Gila Monster in the middle, or actually just a regular Gila Monster, or whatever the hell that lizard is.
Lizard, put a lizard on it and had it walk over the, you know, like it was destroying the trains, and the lizard itself is destroying, you know, they finally find out, and it leads up to the big, which is a pretty cool ending, I'll say, for a film that's that old.
It's fucking hilarious ending where I'll just go ahead and say it because I don't think anybody's ever, like, going to be in suspense about the ending of this movie. They actually drive, like, a Jeep with explosive nitroglycerin into the lizard. And that's one of the funniest damn scenes, because basically what they did was they just took one of those miniature Jeeps, like, from around that time, and built it to scale with just the regular lizard, and kind of, like, just rolled it into the lizard, and then they showed, like, a big explosion.
Yeah.
That's just, it's classic.
It is pretty funny, and anybody that wants to check this out, yeah, this is one of those dollar deals at Walmart. This is what the DVD that we have.
And you get also
DigiView Productions.
You got to mention the dialogue in the film is that classic type of really hokey 50 style, you know, dialogue where you get. I remember one line in particular. A guy walks up to the sheriff and goes, "So have you heard about this whole big lizard thing?"
Yeah,
it's just, you know,
it's a fun movie, and it probably does deserve to be on the next Best of the Bad show, on Shadow Doubt. It's had a pretty good following though for a while, so. Yeah, the Giant Gila Monster. I'm pretty sure this is not really available on any sort of special edition DVD. You can just get the generic version.
Which is a shame. There needs to be a special Gila edition.
Yeah, made out of, you know, the DVD case would be made out of Gila skin.
Mm-hmm. So what do you want to talk about next?
Let's talk about our buddy Nacho Cerda. This new special edition from Anthem Pictures. DVD. Aftermath Genesis Special Edition. Now, a lot of you people aren't familiar with Nacho Cerda. I'm sure you're not, actually. He actually, back in the 90s, throughout the decade, he made three short films. Now, the first one, The Awakening, is is really short. It's like 5-6 minutes. What could you say about The Awakening?
It's just the main gist of it is a guy's in high school, falls asleep, and starts to kind of enact his dream world. He starts to walk around and notice that time has stopped and everything is, you know, like in a dream. And then you come to find out that there's a twist to what's going on.
Yeah, he's not just dreaming. Yeah. So that.
That was actually the first, I think that was the first film he ever did, which was
early
like 1990. 90s.
Yeah.
Was when that was really.
Pretty cool. It reminded me a little bit of the movies that Scott Goldberg does now.
Yeah, it was kind of, I thought it was kind of like Patrick Ray, the way that he does short films too.
But the difference is, I think that he really did use film.
Well, he probably did, back in the 90s.
So we'll move on. We'll go to Aftermath, which everyone always goes, you know, you talk to all these gore hounds, and they love this movie. This is the one he's most well known for.
Yeah.
No doubt.
And this is the one that definitely gets the most recognition. And to say that there's no plot's an understatement. It's basically just, it starts off in a morgue, and with two guys, I guess the guys, forensic guys that do the autopsies, whatever they're called.
Coroners.
Yeah, I guess it's a coroner. So it shows the first guy laying on the slab and the guy's like doing all the Y incision.
It's like a real doll, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's exactly what it reminded me of. It's like they bought two real dolls. I couldn't ever really get that much into it because it just looks so rubber, like the bodies look so rubbery and fake. But it's got a really disturbing scene where he pulls the guy's brain out. He cuts around his cranium and pulls his brain out and stuffs it in his stomach and then sews him back up and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, and the second one where they actually bring the female body in is fucking, it's just about as hardcore as you can get from these type of movies.
Yeah, the gore scenes shit, you know, are really well done, I think. I was amazed at when this came out in 94, I think. Nothing really like this was coming out at that time.
I think they always compare this movie to around that time, Jorg Bugarit necromantic stuff, because it is along the same kind of disturbing lines. And
that's funny you say that, because they actually do have an interview with old Jorg and Nacho.
Yeah, he actually interviewed, I watched this special feature, he actually interviews Nacho Cerda about the film.
Yeah.
And it's pretty interesting because he's German. Nacho Cerda's Spanish, so.
That's fun.
Yeah, it is fun to try to translate exactly what they're saying.
Best way to describe Aftermath is fucking nasty.
It is, yeah. It gives you that feeling like, really, like when you watch Traces of Death, something you shouldn't be watching. You know, that kind of.
No plot at all, like he said, though. It's just these guys, these two coroners or whatever they are, dismembering bodies and just fucking them up and stuff. And I guess what it's trying to do is it's trying to. Scare you at, you know, when you die, you'll be, there's nothing you can do. I mean, you're
at the mercy of somebody else. And when he shows all the stuff that happens with the female body and stuff, that's just horrific. You know, I don't want to give it all away because I'm sure people will probably want to check it out just for that, the gore scenes and stuff, but it's pretty amazingly hardcore with the stuff that he shows.
Now, the next one, and again, you have three short films on here. Aftermath and Genesis are around, 30 minutes apiece, roughly?
Yeah, something like that.
And
Genesis.
Yeah, Genesis is the strangest one. But
this was 98 when he released this one.
Yeah. From what I gather, a sculptor whose wife has recently passed, he decides to sculpt, you know, a statue of his wife in honor of his wife. And he sees that the statue starts bleeding, and then it, you know, flesh starts, I don't know, protruding from the, just really weird, and that's the most I could get, from it. You know,
there in all these films, I don't think there's one word of dialogue.
No.
And that's the thing about it. To explain these films in terms of plots, almost impossible. You have to explain them in terms of visuals, and in that regard, he does like probably his best work, I would say. His most disturbing work is Aftermath by far, but his best work as far as cinematography goes would have to be Genesis.
Oh, yeah.
It's more like the stuff that he did with The Abandoned, I thought, than it was anything else he'd done. You could kind of see the progression of what he was doing.
Yeah, you know, I didn't get Genesis. I didn't understand it that much. I think he, later on he becomes the statue and his wife is, which, yeah.
Yeah, it switches places, and we're not the type of people to sit around and interpret the meanings of film.
That takes too much time. That's what it is.
And plus, I just don't think we could do it.
I don't think we could either. But the look, like he said, this was shot in 2:35:1 anamorphic. This is the only one that was shot like that, and it looked fucking awesome. Just the style, it looked like a mainstream film then, and you know he didn't have the budget to do that. So, yeah, Nacho was a great cinematographer.
I just think that you should probably, okay, for the Gorehound, you should definitely buy this film for Aftermath, because it probably takes, like, it just directly cuts into all the scenes that people who love gore would want to see. There's no plot, there's no fucking discussion or anything else, just all gore. And if you want to see, like, where he got his start with making the kind of film that he made, like, Abandoned, then you should definitely get it for Genesis. But I would recommend that you buy this.
Yeah, I actually did like it. We see a lot of movies where it seems like there's a lot of filler in it, you know. It's a 90-minute movie, but it really doesn't need to be. Or it's a 2-hour movie.
Yeah.
It doesn't really need to be. I would rather watch some movies that aren't considered full length, but don't really bore you, you know what I'm saying? And these didn't. These were interesting the entire run. I think the whole, all the trilogies together.
70 minutes.
70 minutes. So, and they're in Dolby Digital 5.1, mm-hmm. So that's cool. There's a lot of extras on this. You have commentaries on all three films with director Nacho Cerda, making of Aftermath featurette, Jorg Bugarit and Nacho Cerda interview, storyboards, another audio interview with Nacho, scripts, collector booklets, and more DVD-ROM features. So it's stacked, and it comes to us from Anthem Pictures.
That's right. So a lot of people talk about that film, and it'd be a good thing to check that out.
Yeah, go check it out.
Up next, we've got another film, actually, from our good friends over at Anthem Pictures, and that's AnthemDVD.com, by the way. This is The Serial Killer. I don't really think I call it Serial Killer, but that's what's on the cover of it. It's more like a...
It's not a serial killer.
Yeah, it says on the cover, a serial killer is born, but to be quite honest, I don't really remember Serial Killer in this film. But this is Bloodshed from Anthem Pictures.
Bloodshed. Yeah, the movie follows a couple of brothers who are outcasts of the community, and there's a few teen characters in the movie. I think they're teens. You just assume that, I guess. So I think the teens consist of two guys, two girls. I think one of the guys and girls are couples or something like that. Well, it turns out I think one of the, for some reason, you've got, in this case, you've got the boyfriend-girlfriend making out in the forest, right?
Which is always the case, yeah.
And then the other guy friend's asleep in the back. Well, one of the brothers is more of a retarded type than the other. And he stares at the titties like any retard should or would.
Right, of course.
Yeah. And they get out and beat the fuck out of him.
Yeah, and then his brother has to kind of run up and save him from being beaten up. And this kind of triggers something in his brother, because you find out a little bit later that when they were growing up, their father was like a crazy, abusive type of
failure.
Person. Yeah. And they'd pretty much been on their own for their whole life, and they'd kind of isolated themselves. And now that these people came around and kind of rekindled some of the, I guess, violence and stuff from their past.
There's a lot of confusing things in this movie. Somehow, the girlfriend gets lost from the... I never understood that. She's lost in the woods. The retarded guy that got beat up a little bit finds her, and does he kill her, or does he find her, like... They never explained that.
I don't think he killed her. If he did, I didn't show it.
But anyway, he finds her body and takes it back. And the other brother automatically assumes that he killed her, I believe.
Right, yeah.
So he tries to cover it up. then this starts a whole other thing where they're looking for the girl, the police, and all that stuff.
And when they actually come to the house, I know that in the vein of, like, Psycho, they're keeping their dead grandmother's, you know, petrified corpse in there, and I guess that the retarded brother's talking to it and stuff like that.
It probably sounds a lot better than it is, though.
Okay. To be honest, I thought it was pretty competently made. And especially the acting and the cinematography and stuff, it's not that exciting of a film.
Yeah.
And you're kind of left wondering, you know, why they didn't throw in at least a couple more kills if they're going to make a movie of this nature.
I didn't understand, though, the DVD, okay, it had 5.1 on it, okay? It wasn't like Anamorphic widescreen, though. I've never seen that before on a DVD.
It's letterboxed.
Yeah. Why?
I have no idea. Maybe that's something new they're trying to do, like a gimmick.
I don't know.
But
I didn't like it. I just want to flat out tell you, I didn't like it. Had some pretty good parts to it, but for a 90 minutes?
It's, 81 minutes.
It didn't work for me. I've seen too many movies like it, and it just compared to all the others, it wasn't.
Yeah, I'd probably say that, too. It's probably an average film. It's like all the films together that we've seen that revolve around psychos and
farmhouses.
Yeah, and serial killers in the woods type of films and stuff. It's right in the below to below to mid-average horror films. And it's not the worst thing I've ever seen by far. And like I said, the direction's
pretty
good.
It's not Frankenstein's Bloody Nightmare, is it?
No. It's not anything near that bad. But, this is from AnthemDVD.com. If you want to check out, they got a ton of films coming out, and a lot of them are in-house films and much like this one. But this was directed by Jim McMahon.
That's Vince's brother.
Yeah, it's Vince's twin. And that's Bloodshed.
You can pick it up or not.
Yeah. You decide.
Next one up, though. I know that we have is from our good friends at Lionsgate, who's slowly become my favorite company ever in history. Is another movie. Debbie Rochon is in this, along with Brink Stevens and
Robin Griggs.
Robin Griggs is in it. She's looking good in it too.
Yeah, we're gonna meet Robin Griggs soon.
Dead Clowns is the name of this one.
If I want to do like a really brief summary of this film, this is how I would sum it up. And I told you this already. It's Killer Clowns meets The Fog with no sound.
Here's how the movie works to me. If you remember the last 15 minutes of The Fog, where all it is just music, atmosphere, you know, the ghosts are coming for you, whatever. The entire movie is this with Dead Clowns. Now you have these, I think Brink Stevens tries to tell the story about this.
Well, there's a couple people, that's the thing that kills me about it the most, is the only dialogue in the film really is just a bunch of different people, including Brink Stevens, talking about the backstory behind what happened to the clowns.
Right.
And in this film, it's 50 years ago a bridge collapsed in this town and it plunged a circus train into the, I guess it's a river below or the ocean, and the clown car was never recovered, and now there's a huge hurricane going on in the town, and for some reason this caused the reanimated clowns to come back to life.
What is pretty funny about the clowns is, though, they do look like, they're zombie clowns, first of all. They look like zombies from, like, Burial Ground a little bit.
Yeah.
But to me, like, if you try to stretch something like that was in The Fog that worked pretty good for 15 minutes, but it's the entire movie. I mean, that's it. There's no dialogue other than what we've mentioned. I could not believe somebody made something like this that I just didn't like it. That's another one. I probably hated this more than anything we've watched this week.
Well, see, the thing about it is I was trying to figure out if there had to be some kind of problems with the sound or the dubbing of the film or something, because there's several scenes in the movie where somebody will be screaming, like something will happen to them, they'll be screaming, and there'll be no sound at all.
Yeah.
And I was trying to figure out, do they really intentionally mean for this to work like that, or is it just a problem with the sound, or what the deal was? But
I will tell you this, though. Let me say that.
But Debbie Rochon is another one that she doesn't have one single line in this film. She doesn't talk at all.
No, she just looks scared all the time. She sees these zombie clowns. If I was to pay $26.98 for this movie, and this is what I got, yeah, I would mail it back to Lionsgate. I'd probably shit on it first, then I'd mail it back to Lionsgate.
And here's where we come to the impasse here, because I didn't think it was that bad of a film. Now, granted, there's no dialogue really in the film except for people explain the story, but I liked the way that the clowns looked, like it wasn't your normal, you know, face painted up clowns. It was actually really weird looking, like zombie clowns, like from Fulci era zombie clowns. I liked the gore scenes in the film. I thought that they were done really, really well, and there was quite a few of them. And I liked that they tried to do like something comedic with it, because whenever you see the clowns coming, it always shows like the big feet. That's how they're stalking people, is like they show the huge clown shoes and stuff like that. Now, I will give you the fact that it's got a lot of problems, but I don't think that it's anything that they couldn't re-edit this film and put in some decent sound and maybe, you know, fix the editing a little bit that couldn't be fixed. I think overall it's a fairly decent, independent, really low-budget film.
Oh, it is really low-budget.
Yeah.
I just can't, for 90 minutes or however long it is, 80-some minutes, it asked too much out of the art, like the fans and stuff to watch all that, and that was all it was. It was just the stalking of the clowns.
Yeah, I don't know why. I think it was the nostalgia of getting to see a lot of makeup effects and just different, like, ways of disposing of the people and the way the clowns were made up that made me like it, but as far as there's nothing in it.
Let me ask you this, though. If you paid $26.98 for it, would you feel that you got your money?
Buddy, I don't pay $26.98 for anything. I don't give a shit what it is for any one DVD.
You pay that much for your doof bags.
You pay that much for your hemorrhoid cream.
All I'm saying is, to the fans out there, I wouldn't recommend it. I wouldn't tell you to go out and spend your money on it or go rent. I wouldn't recommend renting it. There's a lot better movies out there you can watch.
There is a lot better movies out there, but if you're into this kind of thing, like zombie clowns, if you're into zombie clowns that eat people and makeup effects, then I would recommend you rent it.
I'll say it's nowhere near as bad as Fear of Clowns. Now, that's the ultimate shitty clown movie.
But, yeah, okay, this is Dead Clowns. I believe it was directed by a guy by the name of Steve Sessions. Yeah, this is one of his first films. Like I said, it's got every B-movie star you can think of in
Steve Sessions.
And, by the way, it's one of the most effective indie horror films that the guys at BloodDisgusting.com have seen in years. So, that's all you really need to know.
That's all you need.
And, go to Lionsgate.com to check this out. And that is Dead Clowns.
And I think that's it as far as reviews go. We have some cool stuff up on the site. Though, I want to introduce you folks to Lady Cadaver. Okay, I've got the video of that up, and I've sort of hinted at it a few weeks. I've had it on my computer for a few weeks, but I never have put it up yet. It should be up now on the trailer hitch. What it is from back in like 1985. It's like an Elvira ripoff.
It's like if Elvira was retarded.
Yeah.
What it would kind of look like.
From United Home Video, which is a old company that I think it went out of business shortly thereafter. And they have, like, it's got a bunch of old trailers for old, like, grindhouse-style films on it, too. But it's got them she's the one introducing them. So I thought that would be pretty cool to put up on the site so everybody can check that out.
And it's got to be one of the worst, I guess it's Transylvanian accents attempts that I've ever heard.
Definitely is. But with the DVD or VHS review database, we have a ton of shit up. We're getting, like, you know, hundreds and thousands of DVD reviews, movie reviews, every day over at the
That's true. I think Scatboy did 50 just yesterday.
Well, a few of them I'm looking on here right now. Sledgehammer, which he mentioned earlier, is on there. Mummy Maniac. Now, that's one I've got up on there that I did earlier this week. That is seriously one of the shittiest movies ever made, no doubt. Uwe LaMale, he's the king of shit.
That's what I hear. I haven't seen that many of his movies, thank God.
Now, Blair Witch 63, a.k.a. Kimmy Nagasaki's back doing these written reviews. Neroi the Curse is the one she's doing this week. Scabboy's got a few other ones on here. He's got Hunter's Blood, VHS, Memorial Valley Massacre, Ticks. You gotta love that. I've got one, Home Sweet Home, 1408. Got a new review of that. We got tons of stuff. Brain Damage. J Real's got that one up there. We got a ton of reviews up there. Check it out. It's going to be very soon the largest horror movie review database in the entire world.
In the history of horror films.
Yeah. So we got all that. A lot of stuff's coming up. We're going to have a pretty big announcement next week on a show we're going to be doing 2 weeks from now, which
it's
is a Friday the 13th
possibly
show.
Possibly the biggest announcement we've ever had.
Yeah,
I am. The show, yeah.
It is. It definitely is. And possibly we're talking about next week going to a movie set, which is going
to
be...
Ladies and gentlemen, it's come to our attention that they're actually filming, that somebody actually films stuff in a little city called Hyman, Kentucky.
Yeah.
Which is no bigger. It's actually probably smaller than the town that we live in.
And we'll probably go and check it out next week, I think, if we can make it.
Yeah, if we can possibly do it. And it should be, from what I've seen, it should be a hilarious experience for everybody involved.
Indeed. So a lot of stuff's going on, Dead Pit, and thanks again for everybody to listen. Next week, Michael Felcher, the interview, part two of the interview. So until next week, I'm the Creepy Kentuckian.
And I am Uncle Bill.
And you've been listening to
DeadPit.com.
Did I mention that we're going to be in Rumog Magazine?
We're going to be in Rumog. We did an interview with him, and they're going to put us in there. So you can suck on that thing, are you?
Rumog Magazine!